your seats so we can get our committee meeting started. I'd like to welcome everyone to the Joint Health and Human Services Oversight Committee meeting today. Those of you who are congregating around the coffee pot, if you'll please take your seat, we will get started. I understand there have been a number of revised handouts submitted this morning. And so I'm going to ask the presenter, when the presenter comes forward for their presentation, to please hold up the handout that they're going to be using so that we can be sure that the proper handout is distributed to the committee members. So bear that in mind as we start our committee meeting. First of all, I'd like to recognize our Sergeant-at-Arms for their great work that they do in helping us run our committee as efficiently as possible. Today's House Sergeant-at-Arms are Young Bay, Larry Elliott, and Doug Harris. Our Senate Sergeant-at-Arms are Jim Blackburn, Steve Wilson, and Billy Fritcher. We'd like to welcome these gentlemen with us again today, and thank you for your service. I'd also like to ask and remind all members and also visitors to please turn your cell phones to the silence position so that interruptions will be minimal. You have the agenda published, and we will follow the agenda today with the one added item. First of all, we have minutes that have been distributed from our last meeting, which was conducted on February 14th. I would think that you've had time to review the minutes. Is there a motion to adopt the minutes of the last meeting? Senator Purcell moves that we adopt the minutes that have been presented. Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor of adopting the minutes of February 14th, please say aye. All opposed, no. The minutes are adopted. Now, the next item on our agenda is the April 30th CMS sunset of Medicaid Adult Care Home Personal Care Services and In-Home Personal Care Services. What a mouthful. We'll call up Tara Larson, who's the Chief Clinical Operating Officer of DMA, and Steve Owing, the Chief Business Operating Officer of DMA. And please get us straight on which handout we're going to be operating from. And just if you want to have your discussion from right where the panel sits, that'll be great. Do you need someone to, can you operate the slide projector from there? Okay, please go ahead.
Thank you, Senator Pate. Members of the committee and our chairmen, we have in front of you a PowerPoint that speaks to in-home and adult care home personal care services. Attached to that PowerPoint, we also have an acronym list for you, as well as a standard list of the home and community-based standards that we'll be talking about during our presentation today. So our PowerPoint, we have tried to give you a comprehensive package of what we'll be discussing. We'd like to start off our presentation this morning by actually going over some of the goals of what we're trying to accomplish, not only in terms of correcting any compliance issues that we have with CMS, Centers of Medicaid and Medicare program, but also talk to you a few minutes about the goals of what we're trying to achieve. Those goals include to ensure that the state of North Carolina has a comparable PCS personal care program that supports both the American Disabilities Act as well as the Olmstead Act, and those are two federal requirements that are in place across the country. We also are looking at ensuring that continuity of care for Medicaid recipients currently residing in adult care homes and other assisted living facilities. And that'll play out more as we talk during our presentation this morning. We want to maintain a stable and quality provider network that currently serves some of North Carolina's most vulnerable people who are elderly and are also challenged with disabilities and chronic conditions. We want to offer a safe and affordable community-based housing options with appropriate supports and services as alternative to large congregate settings. We also want to coordinate the action steps required to correct the comparability issues with personal care services, as well as making sure as we work through the identification of INDs, institutions of mental disease, and DOJ's finding letters, the U.S. Department of Justice. As you'll see when we talk this morning, there are many, many pieces that very closely are interrelated and impact or build off of each other. And we also want to coordinate these action steps with the statewide rollout of the 1915 BC Mental Health Developmental Disabilities and Substance Abuse Waiver, because these people that are currently being served, in especially in the adult care homes, are actually a subpopulation of that service as well. So let's talk about, if you will, the current status of personal care services. Over the last several years, DHHS has been working with CMS regarding the comparability of PCS program. So what exactly is comparability? Comparability in terms of the federal government, in terms of CMS, means that if you offer a service, that service needs to look the same across various settings unless certain conditions are met. Particularly with personal care services, we had eligibility to the service was different for in-home PCS, meaning a person coming into my private residence, than what was occurring for personal care services in adult care homes. The rates were different. The payment methodology was different depending on where you live. So basically, the service was not the same across all settings. When we began working with CMS, CMS and the state negotiated a sunset date of February 29, 2012, basically telling the state that we had a year, a little over a year, to correct the issues. On August 8, 2011, we sent a letter to CMS requesting an extension to October of 2012. We, being DHHS and CMS, met in the regional office in Atlanta with a conference call in early December to defend the request for an extension. Basically, we were asking that North Carolina be allowed to 2013 instead of the October or the February date, in order to accomplish all those pieces that we just referenced in our goals. During the calendar year of 2011, we have been meeting several times per month per conference call, sometimes multiple times per week, to review drafts of the amendments, the plans, and discuss the various issues impacting the deadlines, the recipients, the budget impact, and providers. We also have been contracting through CMS with their assigned technical assistance contractor. In late February of 2012, we received an approval for a 60-day extension, which basically extended this February 29th to April 30th. We have been meeting and working with CMS since we received that sunset date to get an additional extension. We have further conversations, and we know from CMS that if we are granted an extension, we will have very specific deliverables and requirements that we have to meet in order for those, for that extension to continue, with the condition that failure to meet those conditions may mean a deferral of federal payment. So what's the issue that we're having with the April 30th or with the February timeline? We consider that the April 30th timeline is unreasonable, and it's unreasonable for several reasons or problematic. We plan to submit the 1915I, or the state plan amendment, on April 1st. As I mentioned in a previous slide, we have been working with CMS on various versions of the draft, and I believe we're actually up on to draft 12 of the actual 1915I. Typically, CMS has, well, they have 90 days for approval if there are no additional questions. Our experience shows that we always get additional questions, despite even that relationship of working with them multiple times throughout the month. And so the 90-day approval really is not realistic. We know upon CMS's approval that we have much to do upon implementation. Some of those activities include we have to have temporary rules promulgated. We have to issue and award the contract for the independent assessment and make all the information technology changes. We have to do extensive provider training. We have to give appropriate notification to recipients. And also, this is something that we can't just send a letter. We're going to need to be doing some personal outreach to some recipients. We have to conduct the independent assessments, and we're talking about clinical assessments on the people who received personal care service. We'll have to do provider attestation for compliance to the home and community-based standards. And if needed, we'll have to work with transitioning the recipients who may need to move. So what exactly is a 1915I? Because we have several questions that people are wondering what that is. The 1915I is actually a part of the Social Security Act that actually outlines the rules and requirements of this particular way of funding some Medicaid services. Some of the criteria include that eligibility criteria for the recipient must be less than a nursing home or intermediate care facility, and you'll hear us refer to institutional level of care. It does allow for targeted eligibility criteria, which is something that you may be used to seeing in our CAPMR or CAPDA waivers, where we can target eligibility. It does require an independent assessment, meaning that the provider who provides the services may not actually help determine eligibility, but it has to be done by somebody external to the action, to the provider agency. It also requires that the state have a conflict of interest so that there's not any conflict between provision of services or other kinds of activities associated with the treatment planning of with the person. It requires specific quality assurance and improvement plans. It actually also allows that the state can write service definitions or actually draw down federal dollars for services that typically aren't under the fee-for-service or the regular Medicaid program. So you can tailor the actual service definition similar to what you have under CAPMRDD or CAPDA. And it does require that the services must be provided by a provider who meets home and community-based standards. So what are our proposed eligibility criteria? As I referenced in our slides, we were talking about being able to really push the eligibility so that it makes sense across settings and it makes sense across the actual areas that people are going to be served. So we've identified two particular areas that the 1915I requires. First, we have to do a target population. The state can have as many target populations or as few target populations. When we began this process over a year ago, we began working with the stakeholders, and we literally identified these particular areas for our target pop. We want to look at people of age, diagnosis, as well as physician-documented functional limitations, meaning, and I'll get into further detail about what that means in terms of does a person need 24 hours of level of care or what exactly is happening with that individual. And also establishes the second benchmark. So once you get in the door on target, what are the more detailed eligibility criteria? And that's where you'll hear us talk about the assessment of persons' daily living skills. I've given you, over the next three slides, more details of what that target population will look like. And we have three target populations. The first one is going to be addressing people with physical disabilities. This would be open to all recipients, regardless of age. It would be based on documented medical condition or physical disability that the physician attests that the limits the person's ability to perform activities of daily living. unmet needs for eligibility would be based on three ADLs. It would also mean, or two ADLs, one of which requires extensive upgrade assistance or a combination of daily living skills and assistance with meal preparation or medication management. Our second target population would include people who have mental illness, intellectual disabilities, or other cognitive impairments. The recipient would need to be over 18. Documented mental illness or cognitive impairment that a physician attests that limits a person's ability to perform the activities of daily living. And by activities of daily living, we're meaning things such as eating, bathing, mobility, toileting, those kinds of activities. And it must require 24-hour caregiver availability. The eligibility would be a similar combination of ADLs or one ADL and set up supervision with. So basically we're looking at this disability or this particular target group, as you can see, would have a different eligibility than the one on the previous slide, and that's what allows us to make sure that we're meeting the needs of the individual in a more global way. The availability of the eye allows us to target some of the eligibility criteria based on the person's condition. The last target population includes those services for people who are elderly. The Medicaid recipient should be 65 years of age and older. This area also talks about physician-documented limitations and functional abilities, but also starts to get at areas that may be found more frequently in people who are elderly and not the same as for people with physical disabilities or with people with mental illness. And you start getting into areas such as being risk of falling, malnutrition, skin breakdown, or complications from medication management. And so our eligibility criteria is different. We're talking about two ADLs, and we're also talking about unmet needs for hands-on assistance. So thus far we've talked very high level about why we're doing the 1915i, what our issues are, what our goals are for the program, what our eligibility criteria, and then we have some general facts about PCS and the 1915i. CMS, once we get the 1915i approved, will address all concerns regarding PCS services in in-home and in adult care homes, which basically means that regardless of where you live, personal care services can be provided across any settings, which means we will no longer have a comparability program. Personal care services will remain the same in terms of provision of services, and by that we mean that the services would look similar across and delivered in the same manner in terms of enhanced or basic services. There's a specific population that presents its own unique challenges, and those are our special care units and adult care homes that actually serve people with dementia or Alzheimer's. We are continuing to work with CMS regarding the best option, but we bring this to your attention because we are very sensitive to that population in terms of needing additional supports and services. One of the questions that the committee sent forward was, what exactly does this mean for providers? So what we've tried to do is actually highlight the provider impact. Regardless of what date the sunset is, if we don't meet the sunset date or correct the comparability, federal Medicaid funding for PCS services will end. So we will no longer be able to draw down the federal share in order to meet the needs of the consumers. So if we continue to provide personal care services, it would not be with federal participation. One of the requirements of the I option or any other home and community-based option would be that providers have to meet home and community-based standards. And by that we mean the settings must reflect home and community characteristics. And I would bring your attention to the last attachment to your PowerPoint. We actually have a detailed list of what some of those home and community-based requirements would actually look like. those home and community-based requirements have to be approved by CMS. And so what you have attached is a list of those characteristics that we have reached agreement with CMS regarding what the characteristics. In summary, those characteristics tend to be that the recipient chooses to, and can go, come and go and take part in community outings. They have the right and freedom to choose who their roommates are, as well as who their providers are. They actually have control over when they eat, when they sleep, visitor access, privacy, room decorations, and the ability to engage freely in the community. And in essence, they have the same freedoms to exercise personal choice as other persons who may not be qualifying for services. All the facilities have a home-like environment, providing access to typical facilities and integrated into the community. So the issue is making sure that that not only are we talking about personal freedoms, but also environmental issues that affect the home. The providers will have to attest to the characteristics, and the state will have to monitor to make sure that the facilities are in compliance. It is our understanding from our basic information that we know to this point that there may be some homes that actually do not meet the current HCBS standards. One additional impact or another additional impact on adult care homes, which although is not directly related to personal care services or to the 1915I, it is happening at the same time that all the other changes with adult care homes is occurring. And that's part of the determination on whether adult care homes actually are deemed to be institution of mental deficiencies or IMDs. This is a federal regulation that has been around for quite some time. If the facility is deemed to be an IMD, and by an IMD, what you're looking at in basic terms is if, based on the bed occupancy, is the number of people with mental health or substance abuse issues greater than 50%. If it's greater than 50%, along with other conditions of the criteria, the agency could be deemed an IMD. If the agency is deemed an IMD, all Medicaid funding for all services for all recipients ceases. So even if the person with the mental illness, a person who's living in an adult care home, who's diabetic, for example, if the facility is deemed to be an IMD, even the services and the Medicaid for that person who's there for diabetes will cease. This actually got brought to the attention of CMS under the DOJ findings, as well as based on complaints and other kinds of information that had been given to CMS over the years about people being served in adult care homes that had mental illness. We currently are looking at 25 homes that approximately 700 recipients that we have reviewed by doing individual clinical assessments to determine whether the mental illness diagnosis is actually primary or secondary. To date, all the recipients have received their clinical assessment, and we are in the process of looking at the 25 homes because there are other factors besides just the mental illness diagnosis that needs to be looked at. We have gathered all types of medical information as well as other kinds of environmental or information from adult care homes to make that determination. We are expected by CMS to make final determination of these 25 homes by July 1 of this year. Once we make the determination, prior to making the determination, we'll be notifying the adult care home regarding whether it's looking like they are close to being an adult, an IMD. If so, we would be working with the facility to actually look at what it would take to get the facility out of the IMD compliance issue. Our concern here is if the facility is deemed to be an IMD and we need to move the person, what's the available housing options for that person? This particular slide just shows you a summary of the actual monitoring activities of home and community base as well as IMD. So what exactly is the impact of all these activities for the recipient? Currently, we serve about 46,000 Medicaid recipients under PCS. Right now, there's about 25,000 that are receiving in-home PCS, and that runs about $19 million per month. Adult care homes, including special care units, which are the units I was referencing that serve people with Alzheimer's or dementia, that serves about 20,000 people, little over $15.5 million a month. So our projected total PCS expenditures for this year runs about $414 million. And Steve will be talking in just a few minutes about the actual other financial information. Approximately, we are looking at either around 3,700 to 4,000 recipients may not meet the 1915I eligibility criteria. This is based on the three levels of target groups that I mentioned in the earlier presentation about physical disabilities, people with mental illness, as well as people who are elderly. We are currently in the process of working with our local counties of departments of social services as well as our local management entities, our LMEs, to actually assist with transitioning those individuals as we need to.
What we have up now is the anticipated cost of the 1915I. And first we started looking at volumes, obviously, in terms of what additional activity we would actually expect to see in terms of total recipients. We looked at three areas, obviously, what's going to happen with enrollment. Medicaid's enrollment typically increases overall about 2% a year. Next year, I think we're projecting about 3%. So we would see some growth there. We also expect a certain percentage of the people currently in homes would appeal their appeal decisions, and they would continue to receive services. And then the Woodwork effect is really the impact of the additional recipients who would come into the program as a result of the 1915I. We looked at both in-home as well as adult care home PCS, and the dollars are actually the impact in state dollars, so this is not the total expenditure impact or the total receipts that the providers would actually see. So in 2013 over 2012, what we expect to see is about $22 million of additional cost for in-home and about $15 million in adult care homes. And this assumes a July 1st implementation. So this is a full-year impact in 2013.
Senator Pate, that concludes our presentation.
Thank you very much. Chairman Dollar?
Just a quick question before you move on. On slides 15 and 16, I think Mr. Owens said that on slide 16, that $21.9 million that's the state's funds, additional funds, as well as $15 million, and you're saying those costs would be, additional costs would be incurred in the upcoming fiscal year, the 2012-2013 fiscal year?
That's correct.
And one other clarification, Ms. Larson, on slide 15, when you have $19 million a month and you have a total projected PCS expenditure $414 million, just two quick questions. Is that SFY 12, the 12-13 fiscal year, and is that just state funds or state and federal?
Chairman Dollar, that is state and federal dollars, and that is for this current fiscal year.
That's what we're currently spending.
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Further questions from members of the committee? Representative Hurley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Of the 25 homes that are there, could we have a list of those, or is that private?
Yes, ma'am. We can get that for you.
Okay. Follow-up, please.
Yes, go ahead.
Will this affect our military that's coming home?
Not unless they are currently residing in one of those homes, or it may not a direct impact. No, ma'am.
Representative Murray.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How does the eligibility criteria under the I waiver compare to the existing eligibility criteria? I'm just trying to get an idea on if this is different from existing eligibility, and if how we're tracking the cost impacts of changing eligibility. I'm sure if we open it up, obviously cost goes, but I want to know how we're tracking that for the future.
We do actually have a summary that we'll be happy to share with the committee in terms of what our eligibility criteria is today versus what it will look like in the future. But right now, just as a high-level summary, in adult care homes, the eligibility criteria, you actually can receive basic personal care services for deficits in one ADL. In the in-home, as of today, it would be three ADLs, so there is the difference. But we can show you how that change is in comparison to the new criteria.
I'd also like to ask some questions about the I waiver, additional questions, if I could.
Yes, go ahead, Representative Murray.
Is the plan at the department to prepare for implementation before CMS has granted authority, or if we know that it's going to be granted, are you preparing for implementation of the I waiver and immediate execution, or are we still operating under a different set of circumstances?
In this particular situation, which is a brand new waiver, a brand new state plan amendment, we would not implement until we actually receive formal approval from CMS. There are pieces or components of the waiver of this particular I option that we would move forward in terms of the attestation from CMS, for CMS in terms of the home and community-based standards. So there are pieces of it that we would move forward with implementation because we've been given verbal agreement with CMS. But as far as formal implementation, we would not until CMS actually grants approval. That is part of the reason why we are asking CMS for a six-month extension. Once they grant approval, we would actually that's why we're asking for the January 1 sunset date, to actually give us 6 months to actually prepare the system for implementation.
So if I'm understanding, as soon as that 6 months, we're asking for 6 months, so at the end of that 6 months, it's turned on immediately.
Yes, sir. There is no transition. It's basically a flip the switch on that date.
The final question, if I may, Mr. Chair, is you mentioned stakeholder involvement. Could you give me a top shelf list of the stakeholders to which you refer? You know, who has been involved in this in assisting the department from the provider sector in developing your plan to implement the I waiver?
When we started our stakeholder group, it was representative of both in-home providers as well as the Adult Care Home and Assisted Living Provider Associations. Those stakeholder groups stopped after several months because of lawsuits that were pending. And so at the advice of counsel, those work groups actually ceased to meet. So at this point, for the last several months, those stakeholder groups have not been meeting.
Chairman Dollar.
Thank you. I have a number of questions, so maybe I'll break them up between other folks that have some questions as well. But let me ask one start out with one that's come to my attention. That is there in slide 15, when we're talking about approximately 3,700 to 4,000 recipients that may not meet the 1915 I eligibility criteria. Who are those particular
Excuse
individuals?
Excuse me for interrupting. Could you go back to that slide, if you would, please?
I'd like to know, first off, who are those individuals? Which are they in facilities, or are they in homes? Are they split? What's the split? And what's the rationale for the disenfranchisement? Is it over the ADLs, whether it's two ADLs or three ADLs? Could you explain that population?
It is a mix. At this particular time, we can provide you more detail of that in a summary spreadsheet, Representative Dollar. But from a very high-level perspective, it is recipients who are in the adult care homes because of the one ADL issue versus two ADLs and the actual meal prep or supervision. Right now, it would also depend on those recipients by the disability category, because in-home right now is two ADLs or three ADLs, so it depends on whether they would meet the criteria. But we can provide you a more detailed analysis.
All right. That being the case, if you're saying those are essentially individuals that are in our adult care homes, as you know, that would represent quite a bit of money, and those funds currently are key, among other revenue sources, of keeping those homes open. So the question is, what is going to be the financial impact on the homes, and do we run the risk of having facilities close? I mean, or are we, for example, in a situation where we're going, as a state, have to provide additional funds? I'm assuming that's part of this, maybe this $15 million figure that you have down there, to shore up those facilities so you don't have thousands of additional people that would be out looking for shelter.
Representative Dollar, what we, in terms of the numbers, the dollars we put in here, this is really a blend of the folks that would not qualify as well as the folks that would, the new folks that would qualify. So we anticipate right now about $15 million of additional funding as a result of the 1959 going into adult care homes.
And just so I'm clear on that particular point, that would help service these 3,700 to 4,000 recipients that would otherwise not qualify for the I waiver?
The $15 million really accounts for the net impact of the increase, the woodwork effect we identified on slide 16. So that's really the additional funds that would come into over and above what we're spending today.
Okay, so, and you may be telling me, and I'm just not understanding, what happens to the services for that 3,700 to 4,000 recipients that would otherwise not meet 1915 I eligibility requirements? Would they continue to receive services or not receive services?
They would not be able to receive personal care services.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, if I could, just to make sure that we're clarifying, that $15.5 million would not go to provide funding for that 3,700 to 4,000 people, Chairman Dollar?
Well, to follow up on that, Mr. Secretary, then what would those funds go for?
Those funds would be for additional people that would qualify for the ADLs in adult care homes that are not currently receiving those services.
So are we making up to the adult care homes what they would be losing in their rate structure, for lack of a better way to say it, by the roughly 4,000 recipients no longer being eligible?
Yes and no, and let me explain that. What we expect is the adult care homes would receive additional $15.5 million in additional payments, some of which would be for people who are new to those adult care homes, but 3,700 to 4,000 people who are currently in adult care homes would cease to receive those saved payments. So on the one hand, adult care homes would be receiving additional payments for additional people, while on the other hand, adult care homes would stop receiving funding for 3,700 to 4,000 people.
Okay, well, let me try, and I'll stop here with this particular line of questioning, but I'll just try one more time. So for those particular 4,000 individuals, would they, irrespective of how they're funded, because most of them are not aware of how they're funded, still be receiving the services that they're receiving today in that facility?
They, as things stand right now, they would not receive those services paid for with Medicaid dollars.
But would they receive those services, irrespective of how the funding works?
that would be a determination that I think would have to be made by each individual adult care home as to whether they would continue to provide services for which they're not being reimbursed through Medicaid. Chairman Dollar is probably not, unless an adult care home were to make the financial decision to continue to provide services for which they are not being reimbursed.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I have some other questions, but I'll hold on those if you want to call on some other members and come back.
Let's see if there are other questions. Senator Tucker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just as quickly as I can go, can somebody help me here? Do I remember a number 16 in 3 when we're talking about adult care homes, a total number of 16 people in adult care homes and 3 folks that are mentally disabled? Is that a number I remember?
16 beds is the cutoff for when a facility may get to be an IMD. So if it's under 16 beds and you have the if you're over 16 beds are over and over the 50%, that's one of the IMD characteristics. So it's under 16 beds, it's not.
Okay, couple of follow-ups, Ms. Chair. This situation with the adult care homes, when did that evolve? Is this just something that just come up that the federal government has called our hands on? Has it been a long-term brewing situation that has just come to fruition and we must without fail deal with it? Where are we on that historically?
Senator Tucker, that has been something that we have been dealing with CMS for some years. It's been a combination of, depending on the issue, comparability we've been dealing with since about 2005, 2006. IMD issue comes back and forth depending on the conversation with CMS. It's been a question over some time. That's part of the issue with our sunset clause. CMS is expecting us to fix the problems.
Okay, and 2 more questions, sir. What are the solutions that you have for housing for these folks? The criteria, are there people willing to take on and set up adult care homes? What's the solution there?
One of our, another reason why we are trying to get the additional time is to actually coordinate the housing issues. We are working with trying to get additional resources through HUD and various other federal fundings to actually work on housing options, but that remains one of our serious concerns is the actual identification of alternative housing. We're also looking at the use of special assistance payments that actually covers room and board. So we're looking at several options, and again, is one of the main reasons why we're trying to get the additional time to work with CMS.
Senator Bingham had mentioned, and we talked about, there are so many small towns in the state where these folks reside. There's something about different addresses or something. I can't remember, quite frankly, but, okay, you're frowning, so I'm wrong there, and I'm good with that. But can we use some of the structures that are abandoned in these towns around to set up adult care homes inside infrastructure and looking at those solutions there? And my final question would be, the surge in eligibility number, is that based on the fact that we are anticipating the Affordable Care Act coming in play?
No, this is just based on our history. As we introduce the program, what we see is, in terms of the as we implement these eligibility criteria, we expect to see a proportion of the population grow that actually uses this service.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Tucker, from answering your first part of your question, I apologize for frowning. I was trying to understand your question.
I confuse myself sometimes.
In terms of being able to utilize the existing infrastructure in communities, with an IMD determination, if the corporate entity or your 16 beds by putting various individual licensed homes or that sort of thing on the same property, if those numbers go above 16, regardless of how it's organized, it still gets counted as over the 16-bed limit. So you have to be really careful about how you and where you locate those kinds of facilities.
No frowns in here, Ms. Larson. It's all smiles. Chairman Burr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Larson, if looking at slide 9 here, in terms of this group, how will the PCS management work for the MI and the DD populations in the 1915 BC waiver areas? I mean, can you go into some detail about that, please?
This actually is different or separate than the BC waiver. So these particular people, this is not included in the capitation payments to the BC. Part of what the integration would be or the coordination would be that this particular population would be included in the care management or the coordination. So there's a good chance that the population that's being served in adult care homes would also be on the capitation or in the capitation for the BC waiver. The personal care service themselves are not included in that waiver. So all the care management and coordination, as well as any of the mental health services, would come out of the BC waiver. The personal care service here would be a fee-for-service. So it could be a combination of multiple funding sources.
Further questions from members of the committee? Chairman Dollar.
Okay. I got a number of questions. And also, I just have to make an observation, and this is not for y'all necessarily to comment on, but it is highly disturbing. So many of these issues have been out here for years and years and years and years and years, and now we're and the solutions haven't come forward. And obviously, a major part of that is these are difficult issues. So I think obviously that has to be acknowledged. But at the same time, I think it's disturbing to the people of this state that these issues have been out there, and then now we're at crunch time, potentially an April 30th deadline, and there's so many questions about this that seems to me to remain unanswered. I'll try to ask maybe a few of them. One question I have is that, when you go back and you look at slide 12 with the provider impact with the 1915I, one concern that I have is for safety of the individuals, because we're talking about now having these individuals in settings in which they can legally just walk away. And the staff is not supposed to stop them at the door or cannot legally. They might be able to encourage them, but they cannot legally prevent them, as I'm reading this and I'm understanding some other things, from actually walking out of the facility. So my additional freedom, I think the concept is an understandable concept. But the question I have is that what ironclad protections are these facilities going to have coming from HHS that they can have the ability to keep these individuals safe?
Representative Dollar, on the top of your home and community-based standard checklist, we have been working with CMS in terms of if the treatment plan or the care plan actually restricts the person's rights or health and safety, that the recipient, the plan would document such. There also is, in other parts of statute, the ability to go through the process of restricting a person's right either through the client rights committees or through guardianship to actually have a different kind of perspective in terms of a person not being able to leave at their free will. So there are some safeguards in place that actually would, I think, address some of the concerns that you express. We, too, have the concerns from a health and safety standpoint, but it does get into due process.
I think that still remains, and some other areas there remain a tremendous concern as to how these individuals are going to actually operate in the real world and in these under these different set of structures. and how we're going to be able to, in day-to-day, be able to keep people safe and inside facilities when they need to be inside facilities. Let me ask this question. We have that April 30th deadline. If it you use the word in here problematic, that obviously is an understatement by many fold. But if that April 30th deadline does not move, do we have identified housing across the state that we could begin moving people into if we have to begin moving them out of these facilities? Do we have an actual hard inventory of places where people can go?
We are in the process or have been working on an inventory, but the short answer to your question, Representative Dollar, is there is not enough housing available for people.
So what we're potentially faced with after April 30th is literally thousands of citizens, vulnerable at-risk citizens, that may not have housing in the state of North Carolina.
That Medicaid will pay for. That is correct, sir.
Which means they won't have housing. And there would potential impacts to those facilities above and beyond the immediate ones that have Medicaid funding. Is that not? Would that not also be correct?
That is correct. From the industry, we do know that Medicaid funding is used to actually offset or to actually fund the overall operations of the home. Yes, sir.
Do we have a list? Do we have an actual number of those individuals potentially impacted? And you're saying already that despite all these years, we don't have an actual hard inventory of housing, except to say that, which I think is accurate, obviously, that at the moment we don't have enough housing identified.
I'm not sure if I totally understood your final question, Representative Dollar, in terms of a list. I mean, we can identify, obviously, all the homes and those that would be impacted by the various, whether it's PCS or IMD or HCBS standards. But in terms of identifying in all communities, all alternative housing, that's going to vary depending on the kind of funding and what's actually available. We do not have that complete list.
So is there an actual plan currently in place for what to do with these very vulnerable citizens around the state should the April 30th deadline hold?
The plan at this point is we are working on transition, but the short answer would be we do not have a place identified for every individual living in an adult care home as an alternative placement.
Thank you. Let me ask a couple of other questions, because this is one I know that will come up among some members, so I'll just go ahead and ask it now. Medicaid PCS is an optional service. What would be the implication and what would be the cost if the state of North Carolina decided not to continue to offer Medicaid PCS services?
You're correct. It is an optional service, and so we would eliminate the $414 million that's projected for this year. It would also mean that the Medicaid funding obviously would not be available for any of the adult care homes or for the in-home PCS, so it would be eliminated across the board.
Do you have done an assessment on what the impact to the, for example, to the facilities would be should that decision, if someone were to want to explore that option?
We've actually put some numbers together. Even though we eliminate those services, we do expect certain individuals to shift. There's also certain individuals under EPSDT that would continue to receive those services. I don't have the number with me, but we have actually done some numbers in terms of what the impact on our expenditures and what that would mean to the industry if we did eliminate the PCS service.
I think it'd be very helpful to this committee and probably to the appropriations folks to have an analysis done of what that option would mean, what would happen, what would be the impacts, both to in-home services as well as to facilities, and what the cost would be. anyway, let me ask one other quick question, if I might, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate your indulgence on the ADLs. The you know, the concern has been with regard to how in-home PCS is structured. I mean, even under the I waiver, to ensure that what we do not have happen is some things that have happened in the past. Obviously, everybody remembers the debacle, billion-dollar debacle with community support. And I realize that there are significant differences here. But I would like to know, I'd like to know what assurances you can give this, this committee, to the General Assembly, that changes in the ADL is not going to open us, open the state up to substantially more cost down the road than what you're currently showing in these slides.
I think the independent assessment actually brings a lot of credibility to the actual level of functioning that the individuals are presenting themselves. So that was one of the issues earlier on, the quality assurance measures and the monitoring. I think going back to Mr. Owen's last slide, we do expect to see some growth in the program because of what's referred to as the woodworking effect, where people who could have been getting the service or now hear about the service could actually come forward. So we are projecting an increase or woodworking effect in that program.
I'm going to recognize Senator Bingham for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll not have as many questions as our co-chair, but I did have one I would like to ask, if I might. I know on this particular slide that we're looking at, it indicates it's that there are homes that currently do not meet these standards. And I was under the impression that a lot of these homes presently have difficult times in funding because of HELP and all the other problems that we're associated with. What will this, in fact, do to those folks? Will they just throw up their hands, and or is this an expensive change for them? I know it just says standards, but I don't know really what that entails.
Senator Bingham, on the last slide, I mean the last handout, attached to your PowerPoint, we have some of the requirements. These may or may not be some physical plant changes. It depends on the current status of the home. Part of what we have been working with the industry or discussing with the industry is the actual process by which the facility may have to make changes. If it's physical plant, it probably would make some providers really search from a business on whether they could continue to stay in business or not. So it's going to vary from home to home depending on where they are in the process.
Does that, and that's a concern. I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. Does that have or draw concern for you that possibly some of these homes may be put in a position that, because I don't know if there's long waiting lists of people to get involved in this, but I gather from what comments I hear that that's not the case.
We do have concerns, Senator Bingham. I mean, our first slide, going back to what our goals, we do want to try to maintain a stable workforce, a quality workforce, and a quality provider network. These particular requirements are federal requirements as a condition of Medicaid participation under any of the home and community-based options, which is what's being explored. We also want to develop alternative housing options, but we see this as a transition, and it can't happen very overnight.
May I ask one follow-up?
Yes, sir. Go ahead, please.
Representative Dollar asks his other 50 questions. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Would there be a possibility, let's say, for example, a business, astute business owner as Senator Tucker who would present a business plan with dollars and cents indicating a loss, that he could appeal this to prove that in fact he couldn't make a go of it, or is there any, or you just either you just throw your hands up and quit, or do you have any other options?
There actually is not an appeal process associated with business decisions regarding financial viability. That literally is a local business decision.
Further questions from members of the committee? Chairman Dollar?
I'll just, for Senator Bingham's sake, if for no one else's sake, I'll refrain from additional questions at this time, but I do want to say that there have been, you know, we don't have a plan, and I appreciate the department's candor in this. We don't have a plan. We don't have an inventory of housing. We don't have probably a full accounting for what the cost would be, not simply to the industry, but if individuals have to begin leaving facilities, that's going to impact our emergency rooms. It's going to impact other parts of the healthcare system that impact on our budget. The IMD question down here, we're talking about 700 residents currently under review. There are implications there for those individuals. There's just a host of unanswered questions and plans that we certainly would wish would be in place at this point in time. And it's also disturbing in terms of what has happened, whether those are for good reasons or bad reasons from a legal perspective, the fact that maybe a lot of our stakeholders haven't been as fully engaged for a variety of reasons in some of the more recent work is concerning as well. So there's a range of concerns out there, and it's certainly something that we're going to have to continue to work on in the General Assembly, because there are tremendous implications for our state and a lot of thousands of citizens.
Representative Avila.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just like a clarification here. We've discussed adult care homes strictly through this whole thing, but would this not affect any of our group homes where people are receiving a PCS? I mean, it's not just limited to the adult care homes. Am I right on that?
That is correct.
Follow up?
Yes, go ahead.
What would the scope then be of the number of people that are going to be affected?
That's, Representative, that's part of the reason why we've done the disability characteristics in terms of the differences with disabilities and mental health and developmental disabilities. So we feel like the implementation would be minimal in terms of the eligibility criteria. Those facilities would need to meet the home and community-based standards, as well as making sure they're not an IMD as well.
Further questions from committee members? Senator Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On the living standards and the last page of the handout, it says visitors must not have conduct requirements beyond respectful behavior toward other residents. What does that mean?
Basically, what we're talking about in that particular requirement is that visitors come and go. You can't, because you don't like someone, just refuse to have the person as a visitor. However, the facility does have the right, when a visitor is disruptive, that they ask them to leave. So it's trying to make sure that recipients get to have people come and go, but they also gives the facility the right to restrict when a provider or a visitor is not appropriate.
Further questions from committee members? Representative Insko.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a question on slide 16 for Ms. Larson, and I'm interested in the woodwork effect. And as I understand it, the I waiver is an entitlement. Some of the people who might be coming out in the woodwork effect are people who currently qualify for a CAP-MRDD program, but since we aren't funding new slots they can't get in those services. So I guess I'm curious about if you know, how will most of those people who are getting in-home services, will they be DD, and will those be in group homes, or will they be across the board? And also in the adult care home, will that be mostly elderly, or will it be a combination?
It's really a combination. We applied a general standard in terms of what we've seen in other programs as we've introduced changes such as this.
Representative Insko, you're correct. Once we put the 1915I in place, it operates like a state plan service does. And so if a person with developmental disabilities or a person who is elderly that meets those eligibility criteria as outlined, then we would need to provide those services.
Can I have a follow-up, please?
Yes, go ahead.
I'm curious about whether or not in-home personal care services, or even facility or a group home personal care services, in some cases wouldn't be more appropriate for some of our DD population instead of a cap slot. And so if a person that might change our waiting list for the cap slots.
Yes, ma'am. We are expecting that this would actually help address some of those issues, not only for CAP-MR, but for CAP-DA as well.
Has anyone put a dollar figure on what might happen with all of these things that I'm hearing now that are swirling around?
We've attempted to put a dollar figure to capture the additional, the woodwork effect, the impact of the folks moving in and out. So I think the dollar figure that I put here is my reasonable expectation of what I think will happen in terms of these changes we've talked about.
Further questions from members of the committee? Representative Hurley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm not sure who this is for, and I'm not sure this is the right place. Several people are coming here to North Carolina for services because evidently we give more than others. Do we have a waiting period for these people?
Representative Hurley, I believe you're referring to eligibility to Medicaid. By federal law, we can't have a waiting period. What we can do is actually require certain conditions of evidence that the person has a legal residence here. In some situations, what you're referring to, what's happening, is the person may come here and get placed in a long-term care facility or a nursing home, and so once they establish residency for X amount of time, then Medicaid does pick, they become a North Carolina resident, and so Medicaid. So that may be what you're referring to.
Further questions from committee members? Hearing none, thank you very much for your presentation today, and I'm sure we will probably be back with further questions as the deadline looms. Next item on the agenda is the discussion of DHHS property leases. Mr. Terry Hatcher, Director of Property and Construction in DHHS. And we want to be sure the correct handout is being handed out. Thank you. Mr. Hatcher, we're ready when you are. You may proceed. Thank you very much, and welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, co-chairs, and members of the committee. What I have for you today is hopefully everybody should have three spreadsheets as handouts. There would be a sheet one and two, and then there's a larger spreadsheet with a lot of data. So in essence, what I'm going to try to do with the overheads are just to try to consolidate as a summary, but all the information that's in that is in those handouts, and the long handout, the large spreadsheet, has a tremendous amount of information on each and every lease. Joining me today is David Krodzinski. He's actually the DHS property officer, and he's probably the real expert on this. But so I've got him with me, and hopefully we can answer any questions that may come forward. In looking at all of the leases statewide, this is that overall summary that I was talking about. And again, the same data is included in the larger spreadsheet. I just pulled out certain parts of it to try to give you a view overall of what things look like statewide. I'd also like to make the comment that these sheets, the information is not static. It changes quite frequently. If you'll notice the first number of the lease agreements, we have 188 statewide. We have leases that are constantly expiring, some being renewed, some that are not being renewed. Different characteristics change that, so these are not static numbers, but they're the best we have as of today. In terms of looking at the leases, as I said, we have about 188 leases statewide, and I think we represent about 80 counties in terms of locations of these leases. So if it's if you don't have one in a particular county, it's because a lot of cases we have regional offices that serve multiple counties. But in looking at our total lease space statewide, we have almost 3,800 employees that are occupying lease space in all the various counties and cities. And we're looking at a total lease square footage of slightly more than a million square feet, which, of course, is a rather significant amount. What we have done, and in the larger spreadsheet that you have, the rows are highlighted, but we have broken out the annual cost of these leases. And that annual cost is in excess of $16 million at this particular point in time. And that is further broken down into the state funding component, about $7.5 million, and about 47% of the total cost. Federal funding, about $7.7 million, dollars and about 48%, and then we have other funding, which is about $750,000, less than 5%.
Excuse me, Mr. Hatcher, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but the slide you're showing, perhaps we're missing it up here. The latest handout we had showed the large spreadsheet and a page entitled Lease Summary, which has roughly 80 municipalities on it throughout the state, and then your staffing numbers by the municipalities. So mentioned, is that the briefing you're giving us, or do we have are we wrong?
I don't believe you have the overall slide presentation, but the information and the summary is the same, and I was presenting this to be as a general overview.
I'm sorry for the interruption. We'll follow your slides.
That's fine, because the other information is really busy if you try to put it on a slide, so I tried to summarize it for you. Okay, back on the lease cost, the last category was the other funding, mostly the receipts base of about $750,000, which is less than 5% of the total cost. And, of course, when you look at all of the cost statewide, we're looking at an average cost per square foot of $13.62. Now, moving to the next slide, this should start matching the information that you have on page one concerning the DHS leases by city, but again, as I said, it's kind of difficult to put them on a slide so that you can read it. So what I've done is broken it up into groups, and really what I'm going to do with that is just more or less highlight some areas. The first slide, or this particular slide, shows Albemarle through Kinston, and what is reflective of course, is that the larger cities, typically, of course, you're going to have more leases, and I can point out a few, Asheville with 7, Charlotte, you know, with 12, Fayetteville 4, Greensboro and with 5, and Greenville 4. And on the next slide is the remainder of the leases by city. And when you look at that, again, similar characteristics. If you look at Raleigh and Wake County, for instance, that's where we have more leases than anywhere else in the state at 28. And then again, as you would think, in Winston-Salem, you know, and Wilmington, we would have more leases as well. Then on the next slide, which should correspond to the second handout, page 2 of the handout, that really lists the staffing by city. And again, I did the same thing. I broke it up into 2 slides for presentation. And again, from Albemarle to Kinston, again, larger cities such as Asheville, 124 staff, Charlotte, 107 staff. And again, similarly in Greensboro, 72, Greenville, 84, Jacksonville, 20, Hickory, 45. So again, similar expectation. And really on the final slide of this presentation, in looking at the staff by city, I'm sure that Raleigh stands out in particular because we have approximately 1,700 staff in lease space, and that's about 45% of all employees statewide that are in lease space, and about 50% of the cost that I showed you on the original slide. So again, rather large presence. And then, as we pointed out, for other locations such as Wilmington, 123, and Winston-Salem, 119. So altogether, that is reflective of the entire 3,798 individuals that are in the space. The final sheet that you have, which is an elongated, should be on legal size spreadsheet, which is still rather busy. But in essence, what we have done is that we have taken each and every one of those leases that I had in my summary, and at the top, we have listed them by division or by office. We've listed the program that is occupying this space, their address, and the cities are done alphabetically and grouped together by cities, the total number of staff, the square footage, the annual cost, and then some additional information, which there was really no way to give a summary, and that's the expiration dates, whether these leases were renewable or not. That would be a yes or a no. The actual per square foot cost for each one of these individual leases. And then, of course, the state funds are highlighted in gray on your slide that shows the state funds and how they're broken out in percentage-wise. And then the federal funds similarly, and then other funds. And also in the final column, we have lessor and some other notes associated with each one of these. So, again, I've gone over and given the summary, and I know the spreadsheet is quite a bit of information to digest, but at this point, that completes, you know, the formal part of the presentation, and I'm very, very happy to answer any questions that you may have.
I would thank you for the presentation. I'd like to ask a question first, if I may. And the sheets that we've been supplied, which shows the leases by city, am I to understand that there are no rural settings for any lease space anywhere in the state? Because the only thing you mention are municipalities.
I just pointed out some where the larger. No, we have a lot of representation. Well, again, the representation of some probably really tiny small towns, probably not have any representation, but some of these are fairly small in looking at the total.
I guess my question was, is everything located in an urban area that you lease, or do we have lease spaces in rural settings that are not particularly in a municipality?
Sir, we do have some of those. As a matter of fact, the Martin County Call Center is really pretty well isolated out in a rural area, so we do have some, and that happens to be a very important one for us.
Thank you. Questions from members of the committee? Representative Dollar.
I'll keep this one to one question. Okay. It would be helpful, because this is something you can't, I don't think you may not be able to answer today, but if we could get a list, I notice on these, the lessors, in some cases we have the individuals, but in certain instances we have LLCs. So it would be good to know who the principals are of these various, in terms of the companies. I'm not concerned about the nonprofits or the community colleges or the counties, but in terms of the companies, the LLCs and the like, if we could get a list of the principals from those companies that correspond to these leases, would be helpful. Thank you.
Yes, sir. We'll be glad to provide that. Thank you.
Further questions from members of the committee? Hearing none, gentlemen, thank you very much for your presentation, and we will be back with you later on if you get that information to us. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Our final presentation before the lunch hour will be the Dorothea Dix property. Mr. Spiros Phlegas, who is the Senior Deputy Secretary for the Department of Administration, and also Mr. Lucky Welch, the Division Director from State Operations in HHS facilities, and Laura White, Team Leader for Psychiatric Hospitals with HHS. If everyone is joined together on that, we will start with our... And Mr. Parker, you're going to make a presentation first. Okay, Mr. Sean Parker from our staff.
Good morning. I've been asked to briefly go over three main points or main tenets of this presentation and just give the overview, and then Mr. Welch will give the specifics related to the Department of Health and Human Services, and Mr. Phlegas will speak to the role that the Department of Administration plays. The three things that I'm touching on are, first, what is the process and requirements for closure, some of the basics on what is allowed or required for sale or lease of state land, and then finally, where the net proceeds will go from this sale. As far as closure is related, in general, the Secretary of HHS has the authority to close the state-operated facilities by developing a plan, complying with certain notice and review requirements, and then getting approval from the governor and the Council of State. And that is also subject to legislative review as long as the General Assembly does not pass legislation disapproving the closure. Over the last 10 years, there's been different special provisions that may have changed some of the requirements. There's been some direction in law that would have explained what may be allowed or what is required for closure. But in the 2010 budget, basically a special provision not withstood all other directions to the contrary and said the statutes will prevail as it relates to Dorothea Dix property. So following the statutory requirements, which are laid out in 122C, 112.1, which speaks to some of the notice and plan requirements, and then 122C, 181, which speaks to the legislative review process. Here has been the very short timeline related to the closure. In November 1st, 2010, the GovOps and the Oversight Committee on Mental Health at the time and the catchment area members were noticed to the plan for closure. On November 9th in 2010, the plan was presented to the Legislative Oversight Committee, and then notice was given to the various appropriation subcommittees as well. In December, the governor and council of state had information to the closure, and I believe that was acted on in December, and that would leave only then the legislative review process. And at the beginning of the 2011 General Assembly, two bills were introduced, which basically postponed the closure until there was a chance for action. In June 18th, when the General Assembly adjourned without taking action, basically at that point, all statutory requirements for closure had been met. The notice in the original review plan, I believe the closure date was anticipated to be March 21st, 2011. And I believe the department will speak to where they are at this point on that. As far as the sale or lease of state lands, well, Article 7 of Chapter 146 governs that. Basically, it's the Department of Administration will make a determination that it's the best interest of the state to go forth with a sale or lease. That must be approved by the Council of State and the governor. If the appraised value for that sale of the land is over $25,000, then there must be a consultation with the Joint Government Operations Oversight Committee. In general, the sale must be for fair market value. There are circumstances where it can be sold for less than fair market value to a public entity or to a non-for-profit. In those circumstances, there must be 30-day notice given to both the GovOps and to the Fiscal Research Division of the General Assembly with the details to that. Upon a sale, the proceeds, how they would be distributed. Well, there's two things that would govern that at this point. Currently, 146-30 sets a formula for how proceeds must be distributed. And as that statute reads currently, if it's appraised for more than $6 million, then 100% of those proceeds would go to the general fund. And when I say that, that would be net proceeds, that there are things within the state plan where some of the money for the cost of the sale would be covered for. But at this point, $6 million or more of appraisal, it would be 100% of the general fund. If it's less than $6 million, then it would have a formula of 25% to the agency that was in control, 25% to the general fund, and then 50% to the retirement system. There's an asterisk to that because currently under Session Law 2011-373, they spoke to how the funds shall be distributed, and that has put a limitation. So if land is sold between before the end of this fiscal year, the net proceeds of $15 million will go directly into the balancing of the budget, and then anything over that will go back to the formula. If the net proceeds are at $15 million, then the assumption is that the appraised value is over $6 million, so it should be the remainder should go to the general fund. And then if it is sold in the next fiscal year between July 1, 2012 and July 1, 2013, then the first $25 million would be reflected into balancing of the budget, and then the remainder would go to the general fund again, most likely, particularly in a circumstance like Dick's where you could not break up the land. And that is the basics on the process. If there's any questions.
Are there any questions of Mr. Parker? Chairman Dollar has a question for you.
I always got a question. If we could get a synopsis or written of your comments for the members, and it would be good if you could email that around to us when you get a chance. Sure. And the other question, this may be partially a rhetorical question, but with regard to the breakdown in terms of distribution of funds as currently in statute, the General Assembly could determine to change that for any disposition of funds from this particular property if it so chose. That would be correct, right?
Yes, sir. Actually, all three of these items I spoke to can be changed by a legislative direction up to a certain point. I mean, You could reopen something that's been closed. You can delay closure. You could, prior to a contract going into, you can change the requirements of the sale, and then certainly you could change through legislative action specific where the proceeds should go.
Well, let me just follow up one speculative question then. If the property at some point in time were to be sold in whole or in part, it would, the General Assembly could determine to put that in a mental health trust fund or some other type of instrument if it chose to do that. That would be an accurate statement. Or would there be a requirement that some portion of that absolutely have to go into a pension fund or that sort of thing?
No requirement. It would be what is directed through the legislation.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Dr. Current.
Yeah, I get this thing on. thank you, Mr. Chairman. Was this determined, well, to back up, if my what memory I have left serves me, to recall that I think Governor Easley appointed a committee to look at all the state-owned properties and make recommendations as to what to do with these properties. Was this involved in that, or was this totally a standalone issue that had to do with the Department of Health and Human Services?
I'm not sure that I understand the question. Are you relating to a action or the closure plan for Dix? Is that was that independent of a total state assets review? I believe so. I believe as part of while it is possible that this also fell well under an assets review, that the closure plan for Dix related, it went back as at least as far as the plan to open the Central Regional Hospital.
Thank you, Mr. Parker. Mr. Flegas, do you have any slides to be shown? Okay, we'll turn this off then so you can proceed. Mr. Flegas and Mr. Welch and Ms. White, please go ahead with your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Since I don't have anything on slides for view, there is a handout that I've provided the members of the committee, and I'll be glad to make the presentation either from here or from the podium at your pleasure.
Why don't you come up to the podium, if you would, sir?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Spiro Flegas, Deputy Secretary with the Department of Administration. The information requested for the presentation as listed on the agenda is a little more involved than what I prepared for this presentation. Some of the information is yet to be determined. Other information may be best responded to by DHHS. I have prepared a summary to place things in perspective and context. Seven slides related to the Dix campus that were developed as part of the ongoing state's master planning effort for Wake County, and I'll review those briefly. I put first plan, master plan for Wake County of state property was done in 1995. I've included, and they gave a 2005 master plan. The only reason I put this slide in was to indicate down in the bottom corner there in the triangle, at that time was planned a new psychiatric hospital to be constructed on the Dix property. Obviously, since the hospital was constructed at Butner and the existing hospital closed, this is kind of water over the dam. The next slide indicated a long-range plan, and the only reason for including this was to indicate, if you look at the nomenclature, number one was future development of DHHS space on the Dix campus, and number four, as part of the nomenclature, was indicated as open space reserve. The third slide I have just gives a brief overview of the entire tract. The total was 531 acres. The slide to the left of that indicates several points, items here that I will talk about later. One is the location of food runners and the healing place. There's also a designation of the soccer fields and a historic cemetery. On that page, the slide to the right, in crosshatched, is property that was allocated, reallocated, to North Carolina State University as a part of their centennial campus, and is known as the Spring Hill Precinct. And NC State does have a master plan for that area. The in preparing the 2007 or update of the 95 plan, there was two concepts that were developed for an essentially a consolidation of DHHS on the Dix campus, and I provided both of those. Option A, Concept A, indicates a consolidated DHHS adjacent to the Spring Hill precinct at on the hill or the ridge of the Dix campus. And Concept B indicated another option of a consolidated campus for DHHS along Lake Wheeler Road there to the south. The area shaded in green was just kind of left indeterminate to indicate that there could be other usage for that property. This plan was presented to members of the General Assembly and members of the Wake delegation.
Mr. Spagas, excuse me. I don't believe all members have color copies of the pictures, and so can you give further definition to what's green and what's yellow, please?
Okay.
And I'm sorry, I butchered your name, sir.
Okay. if you go back to Concept A, there is a cluster of buildings adjacent to the Spring Hill precinct. All the other area around that cluster is shaded in green. And Concept B, a cluster of buildings to be constructed along Lake Wheeler Road, all the rest of the area is shaded in green. When this was presented to the General Assembly, the 2007 plan, several members of the Wake County delegation requested that as part of the master plan that there be shown options for relocation of DHHS off of the Dix property. And the consultant developed two plans. One was a consolidated DHHS option along Blue Ridge Road on property that's currently owned by the state across from the Art Museum. And a second option was developed in the Garner Road campus opposite where the Highway Patrol training facilities are in the SBI lab. Those were kind of test fits to see if the property could be developed for a consolidated DHHS. As part of the master plan development, our consultant reviewed all the available plans that had been done to date on the Dorothea Dix campus for a side-by-side comparison of each, summarizing the use opportunities on that campus. And what they developed, just to show you, and this is online, by the way, on the state property website, our entire master plan is on that, and this is in Volume 2, Tab 4. But they assembled all of the plans done to Dix and put it in one document with a comparison of what each showed, what the merits of each were, and what the differences. Since 1995, there have been 11 different plans prepared dealing with the Dix campus. And that leads us to the appraisal report for the Dix campus. The Department of Administration released the appraisal of the Dorothea Dix property in February. The appraisal is online and available for view at the Department of Administration state property website. And I believe you have been passed a link to that website so you can look at the entire proposal. The appraisal was to estimate both the prospective and current market values, first of approximately 259 acres of land that excluded the 60 acres leased to the city of Raleigh for the soccer fields. And if you can refer to the third page of my slides, there's also approximately 4.4 acres leased to the Healing Place and approximately 7.75 acres leased to Food Runners. And there is 3 acres of a cemetery. The appraisal included approximately 8 acres and a 25,000 square foot food distribution warehouse occupied by the NC Farmers Market. The appraisal was based on the prospective value, that is, assuming that a full market recovery will occur in the next 2 to 3 years. And also what was prepared was a current market value with a marketing period of about 1 year or less. There was a second estimate provided of the same values in marketing periods based on the assumption that the 60-acre soccer field can be applied to open space requirements of a future development plan. The appraisal included an in-depth analysis of potential value of the property as improved. That was considering a rehabilitation, renovation, and conversion cost of the hospital facility to state-occupied offices as a value-in-use option. There were other options considered. The appraisers' concluded in their analysis that all existing buildings would be raised to allow the highest and best use as vacant for the land. The site data was about 341 acres. They used the master plan, Wake County Tax Office, and the Wake County Geographic Information Services. On the property, there's approximately 1.2 million gross square footage of buildings. And the appraiser stated that the estimates were based on conversations to arrive at the appraisal with developers, local developers, leasing agents, documented sales transactions, recent surveys, and public records. Dorothea Dix property has been owned by the state since the 1850s. There are three parcels conveyed by long-term leases: the 60-acre soccer fields, leased to the city of Raleigh for a term of 70 years in 1997. There was no rent paid, and there's approximately 55 years remaining on the term. 4.4 acres was leased to the Healing Place of Wake County for a term of 25 years with an option to renew for 10 years in 1999. The rent was $1 for the term. The remaining term is 12 years plus 10 years. And 7.75 acres was leased to the Food Runners Collaborative for a term of 25 years with an option to renew for 10 years in 2002. The rent was $1 for the term. Remaining term is 15 years plus an additional 10 years of the option. So we get down to the values of the Dix property. Based on the 259 acres, the prospective market value was listed as $84 million. At current market value, this was $58. For the 319 acres, which included the 60 acres of soccer field, the prospective value was appraised at $86 million, and the current market value for the same 319 acres was appraised at $60 million. And on February the 24th, just last month, the Department of Administration issued a request for proposal for tenant representation for the eventual move of state employees from the Dix campus. And again, this full RFP can be found online on the state's procurement system, IPS. The link has been provided as part of the handout. The objectives of this tenant representation was to engage a provider to supplement state property office staff in the relocation of all DHHS employees from the Dorothea Dix campus, leased facilities, and other state-owned space. This was consistent with the master plan, which indicated a consolidated DHHS department. As part of the request for proposal, we want strategic space planning, lease negotiations, and with the state approval, other lease base or traditional fee acquisitions. The scope of work includes, along with the space planning, a funding study to evaluate federal, state, and other sources of funds for use in the relocation. We're asking the provider to help in the preparation of an RFP, provide tenant representation when we receive responses, and also to assist in coordination and the relocation of DHHS. At the conclusion of the study and issuance of an RFP, we should have many of the answers related to cost, time, that many people are looking for. The contractor's compensation for all the work shall be paid by the property owners who enter into leases or other lease base or traditional free acquisitions with the state. So there is no upfront cost to the state. The state is requesting a proposed commission rate as part of the RFP response so that we can better evaluate the proposals. I think common sense tells you that we're going to pay one way or the other for the work done. evaluation criteria for awarding a contract. There's a list of factors. We want to include the corporate background and experience, key personnel, technical competence, their space programming approach, and methodology, only to name a few. We are also requesting a financial statement from the offerers to assess their financial stability and strength, since there will be a study done to make sure that the selected firm can conclude the study. The contract is for 2 years with this particular contract, but can be extended if required. Now, do not confuse the 2 years with the time to actually relocate DHHS staff. The 2 years was essentially an estimate of the study time, RFP negotiations, and those kinds of things in preparation for the relocation. It has been estimated that at the point you arrive at a contract for relocation, it could take anywhere from 3 to 5 years, depending on what option is selected to relocate DHHS off the campus. A mandatory pre-proposal conference was held on March the 8th. Deadline for responding to the RFP and submission of proposals is March the 30th, at which time the proposals will be publicly opened and read. You've heard it said, a journey of 1,000 miles begins with one single step. And this is kind of a single step in that journey. And obviously there are many options dealing with the Dix campus and the extent of the DHHS consolidation and relocation. There are probably as many opinions as how to handle this as there are people in the room. And we hope that this tenant representation and study will provide us answers that will help guide future decisions in dealing with the department. Mr. Chairman, thank you. That concludes my presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Flegas. I'd invite you to go back and join the other panelists at this time, and we would once you get situated, we will go with the further inquiries, and Chairman Dollar would like to ask a question of you now, sir.
Yeah, I'll go ahead and ask this. Well, to make a request, I mean, normally when folks present here, the procedure is that we get remarks in writing. So I would very much like to get the remarks that you've made today and the materials in writing for all the committee members and for us, because, you know, we're talking about a lot of moving parts here. And unless we have these things in writing, it's sometimes gets confused. Well, what was said here, what was said there? And I think we want to be extremely clear, and I mean, because obviously I think the General Assembly is going to want to weigh in rather substantially before any final decisions are made with regard to the disposition of the Dix property. But more than that, obviously all of the other attendant decisions that would be made in terms of what happens with the property. And obviously, I think there are a number of people who are very concerned about the mental health aspects, as well as what do we do with staff, what's the cost, and so on and so forth of HHS, and what sort of timetable we are talking about. And just along that line of the timetable, if I'm understanding you correctly from your remarks, there is no current timetable beyond this RFP for a company to come in and do a 2-year evaluation of all the options. Is that correct? Am I understanding that correctly?
Yes, sir. And the 2 years was kind of an arbitrary time frame. The offeror could come in and complete their work in 6 months, or it could take the full 2 years. So it's we look forward to seeing what timeline is presented by the offerers for their for their work.
And just one follow-up, just for the record, there's no intention on the Department of from the administration to dispose of any acreage whatsoever until such time as the this study comes back with the options and the General Assembly has had its opportunity to act when that is appropriate.
I don't believe we can without everything happening.
I just appreciate y'all having that understanding.
Now then, we would like Mr. Welch and Ms. White, if they would like to make comments, they can do so from the panel seat. Mr. Welch, I believe I see you ready to speak. Please go ahead, Mr. Luckett Welch.
Thank you, Senator Pate and members of the committee. Our process today is to talk with you about the movement of the final patients from Dorothy Dix Hospital campus. As you know, previously we have relocated all but 30 patients from the Dorothy Dix Hospital property. You see in your handout some introductory remarks regarding the process that we need to go through. And Mr. Parker's done an excellent job reviewing those, so I won't go over those again with you this morning. But what we would like to talk about, I think, as the gentleman says, a journey begins with a single step. Well, we're talking about the final step in the closing of Dorothy Dix Hospital. And we're doing this to improve the quality and safety of the patients that we are currently serving on the Dix campus, and it will also reduce operating cost. The process we will now go through is to resubmit a plan to the Joint Legislative Oversight Committees of HHS co-chairs, as well as the Senate and the House Appropriations Committee co-chairs. And we'll also seek approval from the Council of State to move forward with the final closure of the hospital. What we'd like to do, and I've asked Ms. Laura White, our team leader for the hospitals, who is the author of the closure plan, to really go through with you the details of what will happen now so you will understand the process we'll go through to complete this final step of removing all the final patients from Dorothy Dix Hospital campus. So if with your permission, Mr. Chairman, I have Ms. White to proceed.
Ms. White, welcome.
Thank you. Well, as Mr. Welch has said, we have one remaining unit at Dorothea Dix campus, and that's a 30-bed forensic minimum security unit. And at this point, we're developing plans to move that unit and the patients in that unit to Butner, part of Central Regional Hospital. It would be located on the old John Umstead campus, which we are calling the CRH Annex. Central Regional Hospital staff have been working to put together a transition plan. And for those of you that have been here for a while, you know that they're very experienced in putting these plans together. Over the last 4 years, they've transitioned 350 patients, either from the old John Umstead Hospital or from Dorothea Dix Hospital to Central Regional Hospital. And that's also included transitioning over 1,500 staff. So they're very experienced at developing plans that take into account patient care, patient safety, as far as taking care of the staff as well. Currently, the plans are underway to ensure that as patients are relocated from Raleigh to Butner, that the we'll ensure that they have comparable care, treatment, and safety as they do now on the Dix campus. We're really focusing on certain areas, such as treatment. Currently, they receive groups on the Dix campus that teach them such things as anger management, communication skills, recognizing signs of their illness, and all of those types of groups will also be available at Central Regional Hospital. And actually, because they'll be part of the larger hospital system, they'll have more infrastructure, so there'll actually be a broader array of those types of groups and educational opportunities for them. For this group, the forensic minimum security patients,
many of them are involved in employment opportunities that are approved by the court. A small number, usually 4 to 5, work in the community, and then the remainder typically have employment opportunities on campus. That's what they're currently doing in Raleigh, and Central Regional Hospital staff are currently working to ensure that similar types of opportunities are available either on the campus of Central Regional Hospital or in the Butner area. And again, those are employment opportunities as approved by the court. We'll also be ensuring that the same types or levels of social opportunities are available as they are now in Raleigh. Raleigh certainly offers a lot more by virtue of being a larger city, but there are a number of opportunities in the Butner, Durham area. There are churches, community colleges, those types of things. And so transportation is being assessed to ensure that we have the availability to transport people to these types of social opportunities so that that should not be lacking from what they're currently experiencing in Raleigh. And then, of course, each person in the forensic unit has a number of legal situations, and so there's also a plan in place to notify all the necessary components of a person's legal team, including defense attorneys, the attorney general, a district attorney in each involved county. Will be submitting revisions to court orders if that's necessary to indicate that the person will no longer be on the Dix campus but will be in Butner. The superior courts and district courts, anybody who's involved with that legal situation will be ensuring that they're notified well in advance so that all legal issues can be switched to the new county. So we feel like we've really put the effort in place to ensure that the safety, care, and treatment for the 30 patients to be relocated will be addressed well. We also will be transferring the 88 staff that are currently at the Dix campus, at least those that want to transfer. Any that want to transfer will have that opportunity. We do anticipate that there will some that will not choose to drive up to Butner. So we will be working with HR to identify which positions will become vacant and which ones we will need to refill to ensure that we have adequate staffing in Butner. And we're putting plans in place to ensure that all new staff, whether they've transferred from Raleigh or they're newly hired, will have all the necessary orientation and training prior to beginning their work in the Butner setting. The other thing that we're really working on at this point is ensuring that the physical plant is ready to accept the new patients. And they will be moving, as I mentioned, into a unit at the old John Umstead Hospital. R.J. Blackley ADAC has been there, so we've had patients in that area up until just a few months ago. So the location is well ready to receive patients. We'll spruce it up a little bit. We'll paint. We'll strip the floors and clean it up so that it's new when the patients move in, but it's prepared for them. We will be requiring some enhancement of the infrastructure, especially IT and communication. And we think that all of that can be done within 45 days, I'm sorry, of us giving them the okay to proceed. And we think that as far as all of the physical plant requirements, both enhancing the infrastructure and the minor refurbishing, we think that the cost will not exceed $20,000. So once we have all the necessary approvals to proceed, as I mentioned, we think it'll take about 45 days to finalize all these plans and implement them. And we anticipate that we would be able to do that sometime in this coming summer, the summer of 2012. And just kind of as a conclusion, we think that by moving these 30 individuals up to Butner, that actually will provide them even more enhanced opportunities than they have now for a treatment, and at the same time will be able to offer the same level of employment and social opportunities. We also think that from a management standpoint, having all of the forensic operations together in close proximity will allow them to benefit from each other and be a benefit for management and oversight of all of the forensic unit. Thank you.
Thank you for the presentations. Are there questions from any committee members to any of the panelists? Representative Hurley?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't have questions. I just have to speak. And I would be remiss if I didn't speak. When I first came down here in 2007, which is my first year, and there was an offer of $12 million from investors for Dorothea Dix, I sent out a letter. I called the Register of Deeds and found that the value for that particular address was $121 million. And I asked that please, because this belongs to the people of North Carolina, to please not sell this. And I was assured that it wouldn't be sold at that particular time. I was with Justice and Public Safety, and I had more people from the mental health situation to call me with their concerns about this. And I know since Central Regional has been open that they're having trouble with people working there because it's a long way. And I know they talked about even having transportation there for them to work. But we don't have even room for children. Our children are out of state. And our people here don't have room. They're waiting in hospital beds. They're waiting with the police there, chained beds. And I'm just really concerned, and I know there's probably nothing I can do, but I really feel that we need to think of what we're doing. Through the years since 1948, this has been taken for those who wanted it for their purposes. And we have this now, a chance to make a difference, and it should not go. It should not be moved. And I know High Point, I know you talked about High Point, maybe High Point people want, but people do not want it. They tried to fight against it, and they do not want it. But yet the city council and those who did the other things, because there's money involved, and I think since I've been here, it's just money. Everything applies to money. And I just have a really heart-sick feeling about this. And you said there was no cost to the state. It's a tremendous cost to the state with all these people who are out here hurting. Thank you.
Further questions from members of the committee? Senator Bingham.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The question I have, the 3 acres, the cemetery there, there are several people I had in the past looked for constituents at home. Will they be, how will that be handled, that cemetery?
Senator Bingham, I do not have an answer for you. I understand there, I've heard approximately 1,000 graves in that cemetery. So I don't think anything has been determined at this point in time as to whether anything will be relocated or not.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Further questions from members of the committee? Chairman Dollar.
So I just want to make sure I'm clear on this. There have been press releases out and press statements out over the last few weeks that there was, you know, going to be a disposition of the property and what was going to be done with it. But as of this moment, as of right now, there is no hard and fast plan in place for relocating the HHS staff. Where that staff would go, I think it's around 1,300-1,400 people over there. What the associated cost would be of making that relocation, what the lease cost would be, short-term, long-term. In other words, the time frames for that and the like are all still yet to be determined. And, you know, questions is Senator Bingham brought up in terms of the cemetery. I mean, there's a host of questions that are out there. Those questions haven't been put into a plan at this place, at this time. Now, I guess I'm asking this as a question. Is that a fair assessment? And I ask that of the department or Mr. Flagus, either one.
That's correct. Representative Dollar. That's why we're doing the having the study done, to provide additional information that's critical in making decisions over what course of action to take.
Mr. Chairman, if I may.
Yes. Secretary DeLeo.
From the department's perspective, we have begun, Chairman Dollar, that planning, and we are looking at, as I understand in my absence, a presentation was made about leases and so forth. We are looking at what the department would need to do in the eventuality that we would be moved off of the Dix campus. We're looking at consolidation of leases and space. We have a number of divisions that are spread around in a variety of locations. That's not the most efficient way to do business. It's not the most cost-effective way to do business. So we are beginning that planning process from the departmental standpoint as to what will work best for the department, regardless of whether we're located on the Dix campus or if we are going to be located somewhere else.
Well, just to follow up and clarify, if I might, so along that line, you are analyzing the cost and benefits of all of those options, whether that option would be off property as well as an option that might keep you on property in some capacity.
From the department standpoint, yes, we are looking at that. We have made as a department a determination. My predecessor, Secretary Kanzler, had looked at consolidation and moving various divisions or parts of divisions back onto the campus or actually renovated space on the campus. All of those decisions were made with the caveat that we should not make any decisions that cannot be paid for within the next 4 or 5 years in terms of a return on investment. But to answer your initial question directly, yes, we are looking at both the eventualities of consolidating on the campus and looking at the eventuality of how we consolidate and move off the campus.
Thank you.
I would think, Secretary DeLeo, that the General Assembly would want to see a very comprehensive, detailed plan, not only from your department, but also from the state properties viewpoint as to how this would all go. Very detailed, I would think, would be necessary before we could take action on it. Further questions, Dr. Purcell.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I just want to make a statement. It seemed to me throughout all of this discussion about the Dix property over the years, we've got state offices scattered about all over this town. We've got we're paying rent on all these things, and it seems to me the state owns that property. That we are, I'm sure this is probably too late, but serious consideration ought to be given to a very long-range plan that someday we're going to consolidate our state offices in a central location. That's an ideal place to do it. And so apparently we're going to continue to find more rental property all over the city to put the different departments. And I just think that we own the property, and it's an ideal place to consolidate state government, which would make it much more efficient, it would seem to me. But I don't know whether anybody's willing to work on that or not.
Further questions from committee members first? Seeing none, Representative Avila.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This question is directed to Mr. Flagus. There have been a number of entities or agencies involved in this, Department of Administration, HHS. Could you tell me who initiated and paid for the appraisal for this property?
The appraisal was initiated by the department at the request of the governor's office, and it was paid for out of funds for the continued master planning effort. As part of the master plan for state facilities in Wake County.
Follow up. Is that true for the 2-year study that you're going to be doing? Is that where this funding is coming from? How big is that pot, and how much is being spent?
Well, the funding study, as part of the RFP we put out, we made it plain that the successful offer going under contract would receive payment from the property owner if and when, at some point in the future, the state enters into a lease or lease to own or other option, they would be paid for as a commission from the property owner. So the state is not paying for the study up front.
Are there questions from any of the other representatives in the room? Representative Insko.
I just have a comment, and that is that I'm picking up signals that it's the intention of the General Assembly to go move very slowly and very methodically and on this issue, and I think that that's a very smart move, is to move slowly.
Any further questions from members of the committee? Hearing none, thank you very much for being here to discuss this very important issue with us. We will take a one-hour break for lunch, and we will start back up promptly at 1:35. Don't forget, members, to sign your per diem vouchers, please. Sharp. And we will get our meeting started now that recess is over. Before we get into the next item on the agenda, I'd like to make an announcement. The chairs have consulted with each other, and we have asked our staff to develop a means by which we can perhaps have some legislation, proposed legislation for our committee to discuss at our next meeting that will make a concerted effort to see that the property at Dix is not allocated out in any manner until the General Assembly has a chance to study that. So you will see a proposed legislation at our next meeting addressing that issue. Next on the agenda, the Hoke County Pre-K student lunches. We're going to have a report by Dr. Deb Cassidy, Director of the Division of Child Development and Early Education. Dr. Cassidy.
Thank you so much for inviting me today to give an update on our standards, our nutrition standards, and the West Hoke Elementary pre-K program. Let me start by saying that, first of all, we have a child care commission that sets the nutrition standards. So that's really where our nutrition standards come from. We have a 17-member child care commission that meets quarterly. The members of the child care commission are appointed by the governor, the speaker of the house, the president pro tem of the senate. And we have a very diverse membership for this child care commission. It includes for-profit and non-profit providers, family child care home providers, parents, private citizens, pediatricians, and other early childhood specialists. The actual nutrition standards align with the USDA Child and Adult Food Program, known as CACFP. And in our state, of the about 7,900 licensed facilities, over 5,000 of the child care programs currently participate in the CACFP program, which means that they are required, because of federal standards, in order to receive that assistance, to meet those food guidelines. And so, but on top of that, then our Child Care Commission requires that all of our facilities then meet those guidelines. So some of them meet those standards because they're part of CACFP, and the remainder of our programs because they are part of our standards established by the Child Care Commission. Children provided meals that must be provided meals that include the following components as listed up here: one serving of milk, two servings of fruit / vegetables, one serving of grains or bread, and a serving of meat or a meat substitute. These standards were actually established by the Child Care Commission over 20 years ago, so this is not something that has been revised recently. It's something, these particular requirements to meet the USDA food guidelines have been in place for about 20 years. It ensures that all children in regulated programs, in licensed programs in the state, have access to meals that have all of the required elements. And furthermore, meals brought from home that don't have all of these components, it is required that the child care facility, the licensed facility, actually supplement what the child brings from home in order to make that complete meal, so that they have all of the elements. It is of critical importance that we require this. There are oftentimes situations where children bring a lunch from home that is very, very minimal and requires, in some cases, none of the nutritious foods that are required by USDA. The programs determine individually whether or not they would assess a fee to a family if the family's lunch that they send with their child did not meet the food guidelines and they had to supplement. If they have to supplement on a regular basis, they may decide to assess a fee. If it's an occasional kind of thing where they have to provide a carton of milk, they're probably less likely to do that. But that is not something that's dictated by the division. It is up to an individual program to determine whether or not to assess an additional fee for supplementing the lunches. We consider it a real opportunity to be able to educate children and families about nutrition, about the importance of good, healthy eating habits, to really take a focus on the issue of childhood obesity in our licensed facilities in the state, and encourage families to send nutritious lunches and for programs to provide nutritious lunches if they indeed provide lunch for the children. It's an opportunity because obviously we provide some programs provide breakfast, a snack, a lunch, and an afternoon snack as well. So there's lots of opportunities to have experiences with children around food and meals. The teacher is considered to be the role model. We encourage teachers to sit and eat with the children at a table and be that model of eating healthy foods. It's a wonderful learning environment, and we encourage programs to make childhood nutrition and healthy eating a part of the curriculum and part of what we do to educate children as well as families. We know that it's critically important that children have nutritious meals. I think all of us would agree that it's very difficult for children to learn when they're hungry, that they really have to have a nutritious diet in order to be able to be successful and progress in school. It's it's a part of serving the whole child. When you work with young children, as we do in the Division of Child Development and Early Education, we know that we have to think about all the pieces of a child's development, and that includes the child's health and well-being. And so, and we consider the nutrition standards to be a part of that. Specifically, with regard to the West Hoke Elementary pre-K classroom, we have completed our own internal investigation in terms of what occurred there, at least as we can best determine. And what we do know is that this facility is both a pre-K classroom, this particular classroom is a pre-kindergarten classroom, and is also a licensed child care facility. So we basically are responsible for that classroom with regard to both issues, a licensed facility and also a pre-K classroom. In November of last year, 2011, the North Carolina Rated License Assessment Project conducted an assessment in this particular classroom at West Hoke Elementary. And just to say a little bit about that, this is a completely voluntary process. If you are interested in getting more stars in our five-star system, you would request such an assessment be completed. And actually, for our pre-K classrooms, since they are required to have either four or five stars, they would more than likely have an assessment completed. They did this in November. The score that they received on a seven-point scale, this particular classroom, was a 5.92. And that is an outstanding score regardless. So they did very well. But they did not do well on the particular item related to nutrition. And on a seven-point scale, again, they received a score of 2 on that particular item. Obviously, it did not do much to affect their overall score because, as I said, 5.92 is an outstanding score on the scale. On January 26th, as we do in all cases to follow up on the assessment, we send a consultant from the Division of Child Development and Early Education. We send a consultant to visit the program, the teacher, the classroom, the principal, to talk about the assessment results and to assist in any way we can, technical assistance for the teacher, for the principal, about what things they could be doing better. Now, this can be on any item that they might not have scored a 7 on. And when I've looked at the assessment scores, they actually scored many, many, many 7s. Those probably wouldn't be items that would be discussed in any detail. But the other ones, they want to learn from. They want to do better. Every classroom in our pre-K system wants to be perfect, and they aspire to be 7s. So our consultant talked with them about all of those items and specifically about the nutrition item. The teacher, it's our understanding, the teacher asked questions about how can, you know, I'm having a little bit of trouble with parents, you know, understanding what are the pieces that are needed for this, you know, healthy, nutritious lunch, and, you know, how can I help them learn more about what kinds of things should be included. And so that was discussed at that point in time, and that was on January 26th when this consultation visit was completed. The licensing consultant visits both the assessor visit in November and the consultant visit in January. Both of those are observational. This is, you know, we do not intervene. We would not go into a classroom and spend time interacting with the children. We would not spend time actually sifting through children's lunches. That is not part of what we do. We may be there and we may observe during lunchtime and see what's going on. We would see whether or not the teacher actually sits down with children and partakes in lunch with them, those kinds of things. But it is strictly observational. And not intrusive in any way. The visit, the incident, the consultant visiting the West Hoke Elementary classroom did not result in a violation in any way, shape, or form. It was a consultation visit to really help them learn and help them do a better job. Also, just for your information, I mentioned that our licensing standards around nutrition have been in effect for 20 years. With regard to the pre-K requirements, the USDA guidelines being required for pre-K have been in effect since the beginning of Morit 4, 11 years ago at this point. So it's, you know, it's part of what we would do for pre-K, what we would do for licensed child care facilities as well, in terms of providing this kind of consultation and helping teachers learn more about how to, provide the highest nutrition standards for the children who are in these classrooms. So I am pleased to answer any questions, cover any details that I may have missed.
Thank you for the presentation. Chairman Dollar has a question.
Let me start this out with a question. We appreciate all the slides, but can you tell us what happened that day? Run through what actually happened that day with that child's lunch, who did what, and so if you could run through that day with us, we'd be
sure.
Appreciate that.
Sure, and I will do the best I can on this in terms of taking us through the details of that day, because the fact of the matter is that we had no representative from DCDEE or a contractor in the classroom on that day, and I think that has been one of the misunderstandings maybe that has been out there, is that someone from the state was actually in the classroom on, I believe it was January 30th. We did not have anyone in the classroom on that day, so no one from the state was there to remove a lunch, provide a lunch, or in any way intervene with the lunch service on that day. So to the best of our knowledge, a teacher in the classroom provided an additional lunch from the school lunch program to the child who had brought a lunch from home, and to the best of our knowledge was missing one element of a solid, complete, nutritious meal, and that would have been milk. Our recommendation in consulting with a teacher in a program, our recommendation would have been to provide milk for that child. And that would have been all that would have been required. Often what we would do, our recommendation, again, in consulting with programs, for any element that is missing, if a fruit is missing, if a vegetable is missing, we would, many, many classrooms have family-style offerings, and so it would be sufficient for fruit to be on the table. It would be that the child has access to that fruit or some type of vegetable, green beans on the table, so that the child has access. It's not that the child is required to eat it, but that it's the child has access to all of the components of a healthy meal. We understand that it was that an entire lunch tray from the school cafeteria was provided to that child, and that then for that child it became having a lot of lunch items available to them, and then choosing perhaps, it sounds like, something that came from the school menu rather than eating anything from their lunch that was sent from home. That's the information that we have. And again, since we didn't have anyone there firsthand, it's just what we've been able to gather from the school and from others.
Okay, well, a couple things. It was my understanding y'all were investigating that. It's the reason why I asked the question, to find out exactly what did happen, because they are enforcing state rules and regulations, and I think that everyone wanted to be exactly clear. And I guess my question is, what actions has the state taken to ensure that, for example, we don't have, if this was a misunderstanding or misapplication of the standards, situations where a perfectly good, as far as we know, turkey sandwich is being replaced with, you know, a bunch of fried chicken nuggets, which doesn't make sense to the public at all, and doesn't make sense to any of us either.
I understand that, and that our investigation and what we've been able to determine, what I have just said to you, what I have recounted, is what happened on that day. What we do to respond to that, and I want to thank the folks who work with us in the state, including the Resource and Referral System and Smart Start, who have been assisting us in further educating child care facilities about how to handle this type of situation, where it's never that we would want to put the child in a situation where they're choosing between this lunch and this lunch, that it really is that we need to be supplementing the item or the few items and make it as, you know, easy for the child as possible. It's available on the table, so they have access to it. So we have been taking advantage of this opportunity to further educate our facilities, our teachers, our directors, our principals on how this should look in a preschool classroom, because it's a little different with very young children for them to be able to handle this kind of a situation. And so we're really trying to get everyone out there and really educate as best we can about what our rules really say and what they don't say.
Senator Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Cassidy, thank you for your presentation. The question I have goes back to slide number 5, where it says teacher as role model. I don't have a problem with a teacher being a role model. I think that's what we should strive for. I have a problem with the teacher being the role model. I'm curious as to what the protocol is in that setting. If you notice that a child's lunch is substandard according to your standards, and frankly, I grew up on less of a lunch than this kid had, and so I'm really curious about that. But I think that a protocol should exist so that you educate that parent. Because if what we read was close to the truth, what you told that kid is that the government's lunch is better than my mother's lunch. And so it seems like we ought to be educating the mother.
Absolutely.
And so, or at least have that opportunity. That's all I had to say. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Davis. I agree totally that our responsibility is to educate families. And I guess the one piece I did forget is that after our consultant left on the 26th of January, the principal at West Oak Elementary did send a letter out to the parents, the families of children in the pre-K program, and explaining to them what the pieces were, the components of a nutritious lunch. So that's exactly what took place based on the consultation that we provided. And I think, you know, you're totally right. This should be not about blaming the child. There's no way, no situation where that's ever appropriate. If a child is ever made to feel less than good about their family and, you know, the nutritious standards in their household, that would be inappropriate. It's our responsibility, on the other hand, to be sure that because we have this opportunity to provide the best for children when it comes to nutrition standards, then we should take advantage of that opportunity, but in a way that makes the child feel comfortable and provides that education to families.
Representative Hurley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for being here today. I have two questions. First, who paid for that meal, or was a child required to pay for that meal, or how do you do that when they don't bring something?
My understanding is that there, in the letter that was sent home to families, what was said is that families may be asked to pay for an additional lunch if they don't send a complete lunch for their child. In this particular case, the child's family was not charged, is our understanding.
Thank you. Follow-up, please. Do you have many of the preschool early children that have to order their meals the day before? I know I had one recently that told me that their child brought their lunch. They didn't order it the day before, but he forgot his milk, and they wouldn't give him milk.
No. I would have to check on that. I don't know really how many in our pre-K program would require ordering the day before. I'm kind of looking at Janie, doesn't know either. So we can check on that for sure.
I have a question, ma'am, behind you. You need to turn your mic off, I believe. Are chicken nuggets deemed to be more nutritious than sliced turkey?
Expertise on what is more nutritious, I would be shooting in the dark on that one. I'm hesitant to answer that one. And I think we probably, if there's anybody in the room who has better knowledge than I do of nutritional standards, I would ask you to help me out on that one. But I don't really know that, and perhaps, I don't know.
Perhaps the person from Hope County who inspected the child's lunch bag might know. Are there other questions from members of the committee, Dr. Current?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I can remember when I was in grammar school some 70 years ago, and we were taught in health and so forth what a balanced meal was. Now, my question is, are these mothers and daddies, did they not go through our school system, and did they not learn in K through 12 and so forth the same thing that I think most of us learn? Are they just not motivated to do it, or what's the problem?
I would assume that they have been exposed to the same information to which you and I have been exposed. I would honestly say, I mean, I think probably speaking for many of us in this room, that upon occasion we all have probably forgotten a component in our child's lunch. And I was always grateful when, you know, the school would provide that if I packed a lunch that was missing something like milk, and appreciated that the program would provide that. But I can't really answer the question in terms of what families, why it's. And actually, I really do want to comment that this, you know, remember I said this rule has been in place for 20 years. It is not a rule that we actually have to write up very often, because most of our programs are very familiar with the guidelines, and families and programs meet the guidelines, you know, maybe 80 to 90% of the time. So it has not really been an issue till this particular situation.
Senator Tucker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Dr. Cassidy, for your presentation. I appreciate you sharing with us what went on that day. I know you probably don't have any explanation of how this went viral and went national, that North Carolina had a group of people that had badges and were called the Nugget Police. But I regret all the energies it's taken to do that, if, in fact, that report was a misunderstanding. You mentioned earlier about the superintendent or principal or someone in authority sending out to the parents a letter. Is there a list, a standard list of foods and food groups that can be given to parents that compile a nutritious meal mm-hmm. based on the rule that's been in place 20 years? Is that available to parents?
Sure.
And is that sent
sure.
out? Is that sent out to them? I mean, a rule doesn't do any good if
absolutely.
Nobody knows how to apply it or
yeah.
knows that it's even there.
Yeah. Those lists certainly are available. I don't know in this particular situation whether or not it was sent out to the families, but we can check on that. And also, I mean, it you're right. That's just a great idea to give them examples rather than just, you know, kind of what the components are.
Well, follow up. Here I'm getting information that was sent to some of them. My only other question is, everybody gets this at the beginning of every school year. Is that a fair statement?
And that should be the situation, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Other members, questions? Representative Avila.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a couple of questions. Dr. Cassidy, if you could, tell me what is the policy that you have set up in the case of children who have allergies? I'm thinking in terms of milk allergies or problems with gluten.
Absolutely. In those cases, there would be an exception to these requirements. Absolutely. Also, just, you know, a family that might be vegetarian, might have religious beliefs that would, preclude serving dairy and meat together. Absolutely, those exceptions are always, always, always allowed and would be recorded in the classroom. Allergies, you know, religious exceptions, so that it was clear, even if there's a substitute teacher that day, that don't forget that for this child, this is an exception.
Follow up.
Yes, go ahead.
On your slide 8 and point 2, you mention or point out that the incident didn't result in a violation of any type. That's right. Could you explain to me then why the teacher was fired?
I don't know exactly what happened in that regard. There certainly wouldn't be anything from our perspective, from our rules, from our guidelines, our policies, that would have resulted in the teacher being suspended. My understanding is that she was suspended and then resigned. But that would not be a recommendation from us at all in this situation. So that was up to the school system.
Further questions from members of the committee?
Mr. Chair.
Senator, correction, Chairman Burr.
Wrong Burr. You commented about this, a follow-up off of what Chairman Dollar said. Did you actually do some sort of investigation into the, I mean, did someone go down there and look at this, or are you, I guess, basing this off of feedback? Has someone from the division actually been down, spoke with the principal, the parents, and knows about this, or is this more kind of feedback of what you're getting from the on the ground?
This is feedback from our assessor, from our consultant. We did make attempts to communicate with the principal, did not receive.
So no one from the DCD has actually been in contact with the school or been to the school?
We attempted contact, but did not.
Attempted, but couldn't. What was the roadblock there? The principal wouldn't call you back, or the principal wouldn't call the division back, which
yes.
Oversees the program? Okay. Good to know.
Further questions from members of the committee? Hearing none. Wait, we do have one more. I'm sorry. Chairman Dollar.
Is that me?
No, not necessarily. It normally doesn't do that, so I'm not sure why it's doing that today. Just to make a couple of quick clarifications, and that is the only requirement is that if there is an element missing that the teachers, administrators, what have you, see in a child's lunch that maybe they've brought from home, is that they, and I guess the example of the missing the milk, if they provide the milk or provide a apple or whatever it might be, but there's under no circumstances is any child actually forced to eat anything or drink anything that they don't want to eat or drink. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. And just one other quick follow-up question, and that is and you may have addressed this previously, but and I apologize if you did, but and what has the department done, what's the division done since this incident occurred to communicate out to the various centers to ensure that, or what actions have y'all taken or are taking to ensure that we don't have this type of incident occur again?
And I think what we're doing is really ensuring that all of our consultants, as well as our assessors on the Rated License Project, understand their role and that exactly what the procedure, what the policy is. And so we're reinforcing that with all of our consultants, assessors who actually go out into classrooms. And I think we've also been in consultation with Smart Start and the resource and referral system about assisting us in educating families about the nutrition guidelines.
Further questions from members of the committee? Senator Hartzell.
Mr. Chairman, given, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Given who we're going to be listening to next, was the Hope County Health Department and or the school nurse ever consulted with regard to any of this?
Not to my knowledge.
Dr. Cassidy, thank you very much for your...
Mr. Chair, if I could add...
I'm sorry, Chairman Burr.
You're all right. I'm going back to the fact that the school system wouldn't return your phone call, what is the recourse that you have? You know, certainly if you have... You're over, obviously, this program, and if you have one of the local providers who refuses to call you back, what recourse do you have?
You know, typically, something that we can do is to conduct an unannounced visit. I think that would, although I may have just announced it, but that is something that we can do in a situation like this, because there has been such turmoil in terms of what's been going on and new information kind of coming forward. We have not done that yet, but we can.
Okay. No further questions. I hear none. Thank you very much, Dr. Cassidy, for your report. The next item on the agenda is local health departments, and we have three visitors. And you might just want to sit down at the panel over there, and if that was more comfortable to you.
Well, however.
Whichever method suits you. We have Beth Lovett, who's president of the Appalachian District Health Department, which includes Ashe, Allegheny, and Watauga counties. The Dare County Peer Power, Ann Thomas, the Dare County Health Director, and Wilkes County Dental Clinic, Dina Billings, Executive Director of the Wilkes Public Health Dental Clinic. And ladies, we're glad to have you, and if you have, I see you're getting ready for your PowerPoint, and you can go ahead and get started. I guess, Ms. Lovett, you're first.
Yes, okay. Yes. Thank you very much. My name is Beth Lovett. I'm honored to be here. I am the public health director in Ashe, Allegheny, and Watauga counties, but I'm really here today as the president of the North Carolina Association of Local Health Directors, and it's a privilege to be in front of this committee. A couple of handouts you should have in front of you. One is entitled, Public Health Works Every Day to Promote and Protect Health and Prevent Disease. What do local health departments do for North Carolina? So I want to touch on that and then review our legislative agenda with you this afternoon before I introduce my esteemed colleagues. Public health departments in North Carolina promote and protect health and prevent disease. And some of the items that we're most excited to share with you today, under the section entitled Protect, local health departments safeguard against outbreaks, illness, and disease. Excellent information in that section, but one to draw your attention to on the right side of the page are the examples. North Carolina State Fair drew national attention last year after an E. coli outbreak that was managed for you by local public health with assistance from the State Division of Public Health. In the prevention section, we carry out locally driven education, promotion, and prevention strategies. And in North Carolina, we often serve as a safety net for those most in need of care. And how excited we are to let you know that in 2010, North Carolina's infant mortality rate declined sharply to the lowest level in state history. So I just have to say that again. In 2010, North Carolina's infant mortality rate declined to the lowest level in state history. What a remarkable achievement for public health in North Carolina. And the third section on that page is promotion. local health departments promote community and economic health through systems change. And I've got a little catchphrase for you today: public health equals public wealth. We're learning now that when businesses move into our communities, they look at high school graduation rates, and they also look at obesity rates. So public health does mean public wealth. On the back of that page, there are a section called Investing in North Carolina's Health, What Makes Local Health Departments Strong and Effective, and I'm not going to read that to you, but it does include qualified executives, active and engaged local boards of health, and of course, important funding and infrastructure support. And the way we achieve things in North Carolina public health is through strong and coordinated collaboration. So in just a minute or two, you'll get to hear from Ann Thomas and Dina Billings. Our legislative agenda, I hope, has been distributed to you. Do you? Okay, getting those now. So I will review those, and if they're not in front of you, we'll make sure that they are in front of you by the end of this afternoon. Our first legislative agenda item is that we ask that the General Assembly maintain local aid-to-county funding. Often the aid-to-county funding is the only funding that we get that isn't earmarked or siloed to a specific area of work. We're going to share some innovations about that in these next two examples. The second legislative agenda item we have is planning for local county authority to charge cost-based fees for food and lodging inspections. These inspections protect you through inspection and education for food handling. In the 2011 long session, we began some changes in that legislation. And that legislation changed one aspect of the current, rules, and that was the distribution ratio of the small fee that is charged, what is held at the state and what goes out to locals. But the legislation did not adjust the fee. And so this year, we respectfully request this committee to introduce a special provision which would delay the implementation date of the new ratio until July 1st, 2013, which would give us some time to work on our primary agenda item, which is the local authority to charge cost-based fees. And so I see now that you do have the legislative agenda in front of you, so I hope that will be easily referenced. Our third legislative agenda item is to support funding tobacco prevention and treatment programs through the Tobacco Master Settlement dollars. And I would be remiss if we didn't celebrate something else today, and that is since House Bill 2 was adopted, no smoking in restaurants or bars in North Carolina. There has been a 21% decrease in heart attacks presenting in our emergency departments across North Carolina. And again, what a statistic worth repeating, saving public and private dollars, but certainly more importantly, saving lives. The last legislative agenda item, I told my local Board of Commissioners a couple of weeks ago, wouldn't be a good local public health director if I didn't encourage an additional tobacco user fee. It's what I'm calling it, a user fee, an additional $1 per pack fee on cigarettes or a pouch of tobacco or a can of dip has been proven to reduce teen smoking. And if you watch the news in the last 10 days or so, you know that the Surgeon General reports an epidemic of youth smoking. One in three of our youth smoke, and for every three teens who choose to smoke, one will eventually quit, but one will die of tobacco-related illness. So challenging legislative agenda items. And I'd like to introduce Ann Thomas from Dare County, and then immediately after Ann, Dina Billings from Wilkes County, the dental program that's near and dear to my heart as I worked in Wilkes County for 10 years. And then we'd be happy to entertain whatever questions you may have. Thank you.
Thank you, Beth. Good afternoon. I am Ann Thomas, the health director for Dare County, and I really appreciate this opportunity to share with you a program that's a partnership between the Dare County Department of Public Health and the Dare County School Systems that is in its 10-year of operation. It is called Peer Power, and I hope you will see through the presentation how this program is transforming the health of our community and positively impacting the health of our youth. Throughout the presentation, you'll see pictures that depict some of the work that the Peer Power students are doing both in the elementary and middle school and also the work that they're doing in the community. So what is Peer Power? Peer Power is an innovative school-based peer health education program that recognizes youth as our greatest asset and the health of our future. It's a program where high school peer health educators are recruited and trained by public health educators in the health department to develop and deliver age-appropriate and culturally diverse activities. They then mentor and teach middle school and elementary students the lessons they've learned and the lessons that they've created. It empowers and teaches them skills that last them a lifetime, and it also while also increasing their awareness of adopting healthy lifestyle and making healthy lifestyle choices. It targets behaviors responsible for chronic disease and poor health. And while this model right now, this program targets tobacco, physical activity, and nutrition, this model can be used for any modifiable health risk behavior. The beauty of this is that children do learn as they teach. So the goals of Peer Power are to produce positive health behavior changes and create health along the lifespan, to reduce the long-term incidence of chronic disease by reducing health risk behaviors related to chronic disease, to promote academic success because we know healthy children stay in school and learn, reducing health disparities by including cultural competency training and culturally diverse activities, and to reduce healthcare spending by investing in prevention. And why prevention? I'm sure this isn't news to you, but North Carolina statistics show a burden in premature morbidity and mortality caused by diseases of the heart and lung. And tobacco and nutrition and physical activity are the core behavioral factors related to chronic disease prevention. In this picture, which you can't see that well, this is one of the activities of the Peer Power students where 33 students and teachers wore commemorative T-shirts with the number 33 to signify the 33 North Carolinians that die every day from tobacco use. As I mentioned, we focus on tobacco, nutrition, and physical activities as the main behavioral factors related to chronic disease. And why prevention? Because chronic disease takes an economic toll not just on families, but also on our communities. There have been four major studies released between 2008 and 2011 that highlight how investing in prevention saves money. America spends almost $2 trillion a year on health care, much of it to treat preventable illness and disease. And for every dollar spent on health care today, only 4 cents goes towards public health and prevention. In the report that I highlight here, Trust for America's Health and Robert Wood Johnson, Prevention for a Healthier America, Investment in Disease Prevention Yield Significant Savings in Stronger Communities, they concluded that investments of $10 a year in proven community-based programs to increase physical activity, improve nutrition, and prevent smoking and other tobacco use could save the country $16 billion in 5 years, $5 billion in Medicare, $1.9 in Medicaid, and over $9 billion in private payers. They estimated the potential savings in health care costs by state, and in North Carolina, every dollar spent on prevention has the potential to reduce health care spending by $5.6. A 5.1 return could save North Carolina close to $500 million. Why Peer Power? We all know that health behaviors are formed early in life, during early childhood and adolescence, so effective primary prevention should focus on youth. The school student body is a diverse and captive audience. We capture a lot of students in our education. And peers are the number one influence for each other. We know that teens and adolescents respond best to education prevention services that are provided by their peers. They listen to each other, and they hear what their peers say, both the positive and the negative. And we're focusing on the positive, and it's working. As I mentioned, this can be applied to other modifiable behaviors as well, and we're looking into focusing on other areas in the future of this program. School collaboration made sense to us. We have a strong partnership with the Adair County School System, employing a school nurse in every school. We also have a Miles of Smiles dental van that visits all of the schools, provides dentists and an assistant that provides dental care to the un- and underinsured in our community. So with this strong relationship and the mutual desire to enhance school health education in the schools, we sent a 5-member team that included school staff and public health staff to Management Academy for Public Health, a program put on by the UNC School of Public Health and the UNC Keenan Flagler School of Business, where we developed a peer power program and the business plan. Fortunately, KP Reynolds had a request for proposals for 5-year grant funds to reduce diseases of the heart and lung, and so we were awarded a 5-year grant from KP Reynolds Trust Fund. And in 2001, we launched this program, and it was then and is currently being offered as a 1-credit course in the Adair County school systems. We have many other community partners, and Peer Power has really created a climate of community collaboration to address risk factors affecting youth that go beyond health. And these list some of our partners that started out with us and continue. The libraries with a wealth of health resource rooms, the Outer Banks Hospital working on improving nutrition in the schools by educating students about nutrition standards, being able to read food labels, and those sorts of things. Cooperative Extension, they've provided some team-building activities and provide speakers, particularly on leadership for our students. Dare County Parks and Rec have partnered with us on the Peer Power students have advocated and were successful in getting healthy food options in their vending machines. And they also partner with us on a Dare Unplugged event. It's a week-long event in Dare County where youth are encouraged to unplug from TV, computers, et cetera, and engage in physical activity, which Parks and Rec offer as well. The YMCA, Healthy Carolinians of the Outer Banks, working with schools to implement healthy vending machines and also create more physical activity in the schools. So we have many other partners that work with us to make this program a success. As I mentioned, the funding and the cost, we had an initial grant from KP Reynolds Trust Fund, followed by a 3-year Health and Wellness Disparities Initiative grant where we put more of a focus on increasing cultural competency and reducing health disparities. When that funding ran out, because of the effectiveness of this program and its popularity in the schools, we currently fund this with local county and state aid-to-county funds, a combination of the both. The yearly cost for this program is $115,000. When you break that down, the total cost, and this is the average cost over 10 years, $115,000. We have trained 965 students and peer educators, 50 of them being the high school peer health educators, with an average cost per student of $119. But the average cost per community member, with Dare County having almost 34,000 residents, of 3.39 cents. And you'll see why I add that, because much of what the Peer Power students do that we didn't intend in the initial launching of this program is they are really community activists and are really working in the community to make healthy options, easy options for people to make, healthy choices, easy choices. We want to make sure that our outcomes are being met, so we evaluate this formally about every 5 years, and we also survey students at the beginning and the end of each semester to see how effective this program is. UNC Institute for Public Health did an evaluation for us, and the quantitative results were that vegetable consumption increased, as you can see, from 1 to 5 servings per week, fruit consumption as well. The number of days per week that students did moderate physical activity increased from 1 to 3.3 days a week, and 66% of the students reflected an average decrease in their personal body mass index by 4%. A lot of the qualitative results were that parents saw an increase in self-esteem and communication skills in their children. They really saw their kids taking pride in hard work and doing something to benefit their community, and really appreciated the real-life job training skills that these students received. The students indicated a preference and respect for teaching them the effects and consequences of their behaviors as opposed to just being told what to do and what not to do. They had an increased sense of purpose and responsibility, as they reported, and they really enjoyed being a positive role model for other youth in the community. Administrators saw improved maturity level and increased confidence in the youth. The most common comment was the need to expand the program in more grades in the community. As I mentioned, ongoing program monitoring by the peer health educators through surveys pre and post classes during the semester. And we're currently working with East Carolina University Masters of Public Health Program, with one of their professors and graduate assistants, on an evaluation to make sure that we are still on target, achieving the outcomes that we intend, and to also include a longitudinal component to identify those kids that started 10 years ago and seeing what impact that is still making in their lives today. Some of the community health outcomes, which are really, really exciting part of this, is a lot of advocacy and policy change that the youth were able to accomplish. People really do listen when youth speak. Before House Bill 2 went into effect January of 2010, Peer Power students collaborated with other tobacco prevention folks and advocated for restaurants to go smoke-free, and as a result, over 40 local restaurants eliminated their smoking sections directly as an effect of the Peer Power students' work. They successfully advocated for the adoption of tobacco-free parks in Killdevil Hills. They made presentations to the Board of Education and advocated for the adoption of 100% tobacco-free schools policy, which was adopted in 2005, and also were successful in advocating for healthy vending machines at the county's parks and recreation sites. Other outcomes that really helped develop leadership skills in the youth were some merchant education. The students visited and made presentations to merchants about North Carolina's law and the significance of not selling tobacco to minors, and provided merchants with proper signage, and the result of this was a 10 percentage point decrease in noncompliance from 31% to 21% as a result of their efforts. They make a number of presentations to governmental bodies about Great American Smokeout, Kick Butt Stay, Dare Unplugged, and increasing physical activity in the community. And they participated in true leadership workshops on tobacco advocacy, policy change, and prevention. And you can see some of the pictures doing their presentations and presenting the county manager with a certificate of appreciation for making tobacco cessation opportunities available to county employees. Other benefits that we didn't intend was we were asked to submit a journal article to share this as a good practice in public health, and it was published in the Journal of Public Health Management and Practice in September, October 2006, Peer Power, How Dare County is Addressing Chronic Disease Through Innovative Programming. And as a result, we've received requests from many counties to learn more about the program because they're interested in replicating in their communities. Two students received teaching fellow scholarships. It turns out that about half of the students that enroll in Peer Power do so because they're interested in teaching careers and a chance to gain real-life experience, and it solidified their career decision for many. And as I said, two have received teaching fellow scholarships. And hopefully we'll end up agreeing, working in North Carolina public schools or government schools in the near future. Some of the testimonials that I think speak well for the outcomes of Peer Power from a parent: my son does use the information he learned. He was nicer to his sister and tried to be tolerant of everyone after they learned about bullying in the Peer Power class. So it has been applied to bullying as well, which is a significant problem in our schools, and I know many in North Carolina. A Peer Power student testimonial creates a bigger impact. Learn what they are taught because you have to teach it. They said all the information is really sensible, and after the course it will continue to stick with me. We're going to find out if it does. From a community member, this is really a very powerful, I think, social marketing campaign that was developed by the Peer Power students. And it talks about, it was done by the Peer Power class at Manio High School. And it shows a full football field full of students, and how many students will not live in the future if they don't adopt healthy lifestyles, and particularly if they pick up smoking. From a community member, this advertisement, as you see, created by the Peer Power students, really made me stop and think about the damage I was doing to my body. It really influenced my decision to quit smoking. And finally, from a principal from Cape Hatteras Secondary School of Coastal Studies: Peer Power has been part of our school master schedule for a number of years. Once again, I must say that as a small school, we are often limited in courses that we can offer beyond regular academic curricula. And Peer Power has been a wonderful addition to our course offerings for our students. So in summary, positive health behavior changes have been seen among high school and middle school students as a result of Peer Power. It results in significant community health benefit as well. It teaches high school students skills beyond health that benefit them for a lifetime. And there's great potential return on investment, both in improved health status and in reducing health care cost, which is why our slogan is, never underestimate the power of your peers. Be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Okay, we will stop here for questions. Are there any questions in the briefing thus far? You want to go ahead and hear the end of it and then ask questions of either of the three? Senator Hartzell has a question.
Just quickly, can you provide us, Sam, with a copy of the results of the longitudinal studies that you've...
We are just starting that process with ECU, but when it is completed, I will provide you with a copy of that, certainly. Thank you.
Dr. Purcell.
Mr. Chairman, this is a question I'd like to direct to you and the other chairs. We've heard over and over again about the increase in numbers of our youth who are smoking, the dangers of smoking, and Beth Lovett, who is the president of the North Carolina Association of Health Directors, put in a word that we've heard before for increasing tobacco tax by a dollar, which would put us up to the national level for tobacco tax. We've heard that from other folks over and over again, how this would decrease teen smoking. My question to you is, any chance at all that you, as the chairs of this committee, would recommend that this committee adopt a recommendation that or introduce legislation that would increase tobacco tax by a dollar pack?
Certainly worthy of discussion, Dr. Purcell. As you know, this is a very diverse state, a state in which tobacco is grown and marketed and then consumed. And any decision along those lines would be very difficult, I would think, but it is worthy of discussion, especially in light of the fact of the decrease in deaths due to the education program that teenagers are going through now. So I would have no qualms about a discussion of it. Further
questions? Can I hear from the other chairs?
Would the other chairs care to answer?
I appreciate hearing your comments on that. Thank you.
One final comment, Mr. Chairman. If this committee doesn't recommend that, it has no chance of going anywhere.
Further, are there any further questions at this time? If not, we will hear from our final presenter, Ms. Billings.
Good afternoon. My name is Dina Billings, and I'm the director for the Wilkes Public Health Dental Clinic in Wilkes County, North Carolina. Thank you for this opportunity. The Wilkes Public Health Dental Clinic was created in the northwest area of the state where access to dental care was very limited. At the time we created the clinic, there was only one dentist for about 6,000 people. The state average at that time was one dentist for 2,500. So you can see we were severely underserved. The creation of the dental clinic came as a result of a community outcry for dental care needs, particularly for our children. The United Way did a community health assessment and found that that was the number one problem in Wilkes County was dental needs among our children. There was a lot of community support initially for the dental clinic. One of our partners was Smart Start, who gave us funds to buy equipment for our first office. About the same time that we started was when, and I know the state probably doesn't like to talk about this, but there was a lawsuit involving Medicaid and access to care and the low reimbursement rates among with Medicaid. One of the children that was named as a plaintiff in the lawsuit was became a patient of ours in the clinic and did gain access to care. We started in a retired dentist office in 2000. When we started, we had over 600 people on the waiting list just very quickly after we started. There were people standing on that porch and in the driveway. It was standing room only. When we started in 2000, for the first year, 100% of our patients were Medicaid and Health Choice recipients. And primarily we focused on children, and the reason for that was that children in our county were having to drive an hour to an hour and a half away just to get dental services because we had very few dentists that would see children, especially the very young children, and no one that would see Medicaid. In March of 2001, through the efforts of a local nonprofit called the Help Foundation, we were able to acquire a facility in a medical complex called West Park. In addition to the local foundation, Kate B. Reynolds, the Duke Endowment, our local hospital, our local government, and Smart Start, and there were many others, provided assistance to be able to renovate that space and purchase the equipment.
And one thing that we have had in this community, we feel very fortunate, is that through the Health Foundation, over $1 million have been received in donations just in our community to support our clinic. When we opened in West Park, we had 6 treatment rooms, it was designed mainly for children, but we were very fortunate to be able to have state-of-the-art equipment. Also that same year, which we were just overwhelmed with joy, we got the facility started in March. We also received two private donations. And the donors wanted us to buy a mobile dental clinic. And so we did. And this is our mobile dental clinic. We started in September 2001. We serve all 23 schools in Wilkes County. And we have a full-time dentist, a full-time hygienist, and an assistant who work on our dental clinic. Having the dental clinic has eliminated problems of transportation, the parents' inability to get the children to a dentist appointment, and also the children missing school time to receive dental care. Many of the parents of our children also needed to have dental care and were unable to obtain it in our area. So in 2004, we decided to expand the children's clinic and add an adult clinic. Again, most of these adults were on Medicaid and Health Choice. But since 2004, presently, about 35% of our adult patients are self-pay. And what has happened is a lot of our patients are the working poor. We have middle-class families that are now, because of either health issues or because of job loss of jobs, are receiving help through Medicaid or Health Choice for their children and themselves to be able to get dental care. The majority of our clients that we see are white and are just simply in need of a little extra help. With the expansion, we opened the children's clinic that is very child-friendly. The kids love coming to the dental clinic. We sort of did an animal theme on this side. We have 7 treatment rooms. We expanded so that we could see more kids. And on the adult side, we have 6 treatment rooms. And all of this is linked together into one big facility. When we started, we had 1 full-time dentist and the support staff. We saw about 30 patients a day. And then we started, as we were able to grow our facility, we started adding more providers. Now we presently have 6 full-time dentists and the support staff. We see about 120 patients a day. And we have been able to serve over 19,000 patients in this facility. We're open from 7:30 in the morning to 5:30 in the afternoon, and we're open Monday through Friday. So we have rather long days. In addition to providing treatment, we also focus on community outreach. One of the events that we participate in is Give Kids a Smile. Give Kids a Smile is a program that is sponsored by the American Dental Association and the North Carolina Dental Society. And on the first Friday in February, we provide free dental work for as many kids as possible. These are children that have been identified by the school nurse or by the counselors that do not have any insurance coverage at all, no Medicaid, Health Choice, private insurance, but are very needy. Generally, we give away that day about $25,000 in free dental care. This is in addition to what we do on a daily basis. We also have a dental health fair because February is National Children's Dental Health Month, and we provide information and resources in regards to dental care to try to strengthen the knowledge of our parents and our children about the importance of dental care. One of the common things that we always hear is, why are baby teeth important? And we all know that those, or hopefully you know, that those baby teeth last till the children are about 12 or 14 years old. And so it's very important for their growth and development for them to keep their teeth and for them to be healthy. Our key success factors is our community support. We had the community rallied from the very beginning. Tremendous support from everybody. And if you look at this list, there are people on this list that you don't normally think about, like the Pastoral Association. We had many churches that were involved in helping us get the clinic started. We had the local community college. We had the hospital, as well as just private citizens that saw the need and wanted to make an impact and a change in what was happening in Wilkes County. Another important factor that we have in Wilkes County that I know other communities struggle against is we had 100% support of our local dentist. In our area, we were so underserved that the local dentist didn't have room to add another Medicaid patient or a health choice patient. And they were so supportive of us being able to provide a clinic where we could see these individuals, because I think they felt a little guilty that they just didn't have time to add anybody extra. In addition to that support, they also funded or provided funding for the clinic. They didn't just say, yes, we support the clinic. They gave us money. They served on the committee. We had a dentist that headed the construction committee for the facility. We had one that was in charge of the clinic operations. So they put a lot of time and effort themselves into getting this dental clinic started. We also worked very closely with the Office of Rural Health for recruitment assistance. Being in Northwest North Carolina, sometimes it's hard to recruit dentists to that area, and they have helped us tremendously. We worked with the state Medicaid office in terms of being able to make sure that we were billing correctly, and also just getting more information about how we could be more effective in what we did. We have a very experienced and dedicated staff. Another thing that people look at when they look at our clinic is, how are you self-supporting? We have been able to be self-supporting after that first year of operations. All of our building expenses, though, have come from grant monies or local donations. But the operating expenses have come by being able to operate efficiently in providing services for the individuals. Our positive outcomes have been that we have been able to change the focus of our care for our patients, from just relieving pain to now prevention. When we started all day long, we had children coming in with a cavity in almost every single tooth. And we're talking about like 3, 4, 5, 6-year-olds. We're talking about pre-K and early elementary kids. Now then, it is rare for us to see that. We still see some, but it's much fewer cases. And the decay that we see is more limited. It's not as widespread. When you talk about that in terms of dollars, though, if you take one child, a 4-year-old or a 5-year-old that has decay in every tooth, you're looking at about $3,000 to $4,000 is what you would end up billing Medicaid. We saw at least 200 kids in that situation. That's $800,000, close to $1 million in Medicaid funds that you're spending. Now when that child comes to our office twice a year, you're spending about $350 a child. And, you know, that equates to about $70,000 in Medicaid assistance. That's the way we like it. We like the fact that they're not coming to us in pain. The other thing we've been able to do is to reduce the number of emergency room visits. A lot of people go to the emergency room for dental pain. One of the things that happens in the emergency room is most of them do not have a dentist present, so they can't treat these individuals. We have worked with our emergency department to be able to train our doctors to where they can provide some relief of pain in regards to giving them an injection to numb that situation. We have found that many patients elect not to have that treatment and thus do not go back to the emergency room. They would rather have a dentist providing that than a medical doctor. But they also go seeking pain medication. We have collaborated with our emergency department that when a patient goes to the emergency department for dental pain, they get information on our dental clinic, and they're basically told, don't come back, go get that tooth taken care of. And so we have an open clinic that these patients can just show up and have that tooth taken care of at that time. One of the things that I'm most proud of is what we've done for our kids. In Wilkes County, fifth graders, we're talking about, 11-year-olds, 10, 11-year-olds. 82% of those kids now have sealants. Those are plastic coatings on their teeth. When you put a plastic coating on the surface of the tooth, you are helping to prevent a cavity from ever forming. And so thus we've reduced the caries rate. We also have about 50% of our Medicaid children in Wilkes County that are receiving care. Among all Medicaid recipients, we average about 36 to 37% getting dental services. The national average, according to the ADA, is only 40%. So in Wilkes County, we're right at the national average in terms of the number of individuals that are getting dental services. So we're very, very proud of the fact that we're serving the majority of the Medicaid population. My final picture is our success board, caught with no cavities. And in this area, we sort of have an ocean kind of theme, and we have this board up. And every time a child comes in each month and they have no cavities, we put their picture on the board. And we love feeling this board because that tells us how successful we've been. It also lets us know how far we've came. We do not want any child to go to bed at night with a toothache. And we really would like to eliminate caries or cavities among the children in Wilkes County. So that's our goal. And we think that we have been pretty successful in doing that. Thank you.
Thank you for the presentation and to the other presenters. Are there any questions, any remaining questions from members of the committee? Representative Jones.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just like to make a comment, if I may, and Ms. Billings, I just congratulate you and Wilkes County. This sounds like a success story to be proud of. I'm actually one of the three dentists in the room on the committee. We have Senator Davis, Representative Current, myself, and we're pretty aware of the concerns in the state and the need for this type thing. And I just want to, encourage our committee. I think this is the right thing to do, certainly for the health care of the citizens of our state. But and I think you pointed this out toward the end, but just to directly address it, it certainly saves money. You know, when we keep these patients out of the emergency rooms, when we are focusing on prevention of treatment, and by the way, congratulations on having the highest rate of sealants in the state for fifth graders. That's a great accomplishment. But, Mr. Chairman, I would just suggest that this is certainly a way that I think we can continue to look at. I'd like to see the proliferation of more of these clinics in the state like this. I think this is a model that we need to be following in more areas. I think dentists in areas all over the state would welcome this, and you would get the community involvement and the involvement of different ones like you've mentioned. So anyway, I just congratulate you, and I hope this is something that as we're continuing to look at the best way we can provide health services to the citizens of our state while we're saving money and doing that, I think that these health clinics are certainly something we need to look at. Thank you.
Representative Current.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wanted to ask a question, and let me add my congratulations, too, for a job well done. In 1996, will you re-clarify what you said about that dental health task force? What were the conditions in Wilkes County at that time as far as dentists and so forth?
We had one pediatric dentist, and he had been there for some time. He was seeing some Medicaid children, but he wasn't taking any new Medicaid children. We had one more general dentist that would see children on a regular basis. But again, Medicaid wasn't something that they wanted to take. Most of the other dentists that we had in our county would see children, but they wanted the children to be, you know, 10, 11, 12 years old. They had to be older. Our clinic sees children starting at age 1, which is a new recommendation that we began care at age 1. And so we started seeing the younger children that would have to go see the specialist out of county. We still did some referrals, but we started seeing those younger children. And there really wasn't anywhere for them to go. And it didn't matter if they had private insurance or not. We were so underserved, there were not dentists that could even see them.
Follow up, Mike.
Yes, go ahead, sir.
Yes, sir. And you paid tribute to the support for local dentists. Would you say then that most of them, I assume, are members of the North Carolina Dental Society or their local society?
Yes, they are.
Did you see effort on their part in not only financially but in willing to volunteer and so forth and so on to help make this a successful program?
Yes, they did. In fact, in the formation, we met monthly, and those dentists took time out of their practice to come to these meetings. We had one dentist that was totally in charge of construction of our facility, and also recommendations in terms of equipment. And so they spent many of hours away from their private practice to help us be able to put all the components together to have a successful office, and made a lot of recommendations that have carried us through to now.
One final thing, if I might. Would you be willing to come to another committee that I'm involved with and sort of state that? We got beat up pretty well here at a meeting recently, and the dental profession was pointed out to be just a very self-serving organization that really could care less for the benefits of the underserved. And based on what I heard you say, based on what I've seen happen in my career, that's a false assumption, and I think we may have to deal with that on the floor of this House before this is done, and we may need you. And thank you very much, and congratulations again.
I'd certainly be glad to do that. I think one of the elements that makes it so important is how desperate do you get? And we were desperate in Wilkes County when we started this clinic. We had some great dentists, and they're still helping us today. I mean, they didn't stop once we got the clinic started. In fact, I have a few that I've talked to weekly that still give me advice, help assist me in any way that I need. So, yes, and that partnership is wonderful, and that's part of why we're so successful.
Representative Jones.
Thank you again, Mr. Chairman. Just to follow up, I do have a question this time, but you did a good job in kind of walking us through the history of how the clinic developed and how it's grown through the years. I'm just curious, from your perspective, to what degree is this kind of a unique Wilkes County effort, or is this a model that you see being followed in other areas in particular? Because it's a model that I think we need to be following in many areas where we're not. I just wondered, as far as the particulars of the model that you kind of walked us through, what can you tell us about that?
I'm involved in a lot of things throughout the state, and lots of things that we've done in Wilkes County has been shared with lots of dental clinics. Different little pieces of it have been shared with lots of clinics across the state, and we have helped some other clinics get started. I became involved in the Southern Piedmont Partnership for Public Health, which involves not clinics in our area. It's in the Charlotte, Gastonia, Stanley County, Cabarrus, all of that area. We had a meeting several years ago, and I was at that meeting and got asked to be part of that partnership and have been working with that ever since that group started. And then I organized the Dental Health Task Force for the Northwest Partnership, which involves clinics in Ashe, Allegheny, Watauga, Forsyth, Davison, all of that area. So I'm involved in two different clinics, or two different groups, work groups. And that's what we talk about. We talk about how can we be successful in our clinics doing the same thing and try to share with each other the components that make us successful. We have been looked at by several groups, including the East Carolina Dental School. They came and spent some time with us, not only looked at our clinic as a pattern for what they want to do, but also learning as well about how we were successful. As well as we have had people from out of state. I entertained a group from Greenville, South Carolina, who was trying to do the same thing. So certainly I'm available to share our model with others. We just, when I put up that slide about the community support, that's a key. That is the key. And that's what's helped us be successful.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead.
I'll just comment, you know, certainly aware that there are, you know, dental clinics around the state. In my home county in Rockingham Public Health, we have a dental clinic. Ms. Chairman, it would be helpful if someone could provide us with information. How many dental clinics are there like this throughout the state? You know, how, and maybe the numbers on that, how many providers are there? How many patients are being served? Because I do think this is a particular area where we can really look at that we might want to address and increase, and in the long run maybe decrease the overall dollars paid out and get better returns. So
we'll see if we can't get that information for you. I know that down in my district there are a couple operating. One operates out of the community college, and they're using the equipment at the community college for dental, that the dental hygienists use in their training. And I went up there the other day, and they had a room full of kids, and very helpful to them. And so I think it's certainly something that needs to be replicated all across the state. If it's not, yes.
Just in follow-up, we'll be happy to get that information about the public health dental clinics in North Carolina and get that back to this committee, including the details of numbers served and that sort of thing.
Thank you. We'd appreciate that. It's very unusual to have two dentists agree on the same thing, and when we have a third one, it will be most unique. Senator Davis.
Well, I have a point of agreement. I would like to add my accolades to what the Wilkesboro has done. I know the hurdles that you were involved with because I helped establish, as a county commissioner, the adult dental clinic in Macon County, in addition to the molar roller that serves the schools. But I would like to take exception to Wilkesboro calling itself Northwest North Carolina. I have to drive 3 hours east to get there.
Thank you for those outrageous comments. Very well spoken. Are there any other questions from members of the committee for members of the panel? Chairman Dollar.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would certainly add my congratulations to both Dare County and their peer power program and the dental clinic program effort that you put in place in Wilkes County. I do have just one question I want to put out. Obviously, you've talked about the association talked about its legislative agenda, but my question is, are there and maybe you could just touch on these and provide us with additional information at a later time or in writing, but are there operational issues from the standpoint of the local health departments? Are there operational issues, and I'm talking about non-budget items per se, that y'all see as health department directors that we might be able to, that the state might be able to help you with? I mean, obviously, there are always, you have tremendous challenges in your jobs, but I'm just curious in terms of operational matters that the state might be, or the General Assembly might be able to help with, or might need to address that we haven't been addressing.
I'll be happy to respond and say that nothing in particular comes to mind, but I would be happy to take that question back to our association because we are always interested that you're interested. So I'll be glad to follow up and get something back to you regarding that.
Thank you.
Representative Avila.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If I might, I'd like to ask Ms. Thomas a couple of questions about the Dare County program.
Be mindful of the time, please.
I will. These are high school students that are trained and work with middle and elementary students. Am I correct?
Correct.
Okay. And your program's been in effect since 2001. All right. I was interested in the fact that when you did the evaluation, or UNC did the evaluation, since you placed such emphasis on cigarette smoking and things of that nature, there was no follow-up to find out how your statistics stand up against the statistics we're hearing now of one in every three students. Have you seen the effect in your student body with this program in relation to cigarette smoking?
We have seen that, and it was I neglected to put this in here, but through our youth risk behavior survey as well, I don't have the numbers off the top of my head, but there is a reduction in youth starting to smoke, and also a number of students who have quit smoking as a result of learning what the consequences of that behavior does.
Further questions from members of the committee? Hearing none, ladies, thank you very much for the most interesting presentations today, and we thank you so much.
Thank you so much for the opportunity to be here, and I was remiss in not introducing our lobbyist. Lynette Tolson is in the back of the room, and she is a familiar face around here, so if you have additional questions that might come up, Lynette, it's a great point of contact for us, and thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for your coming in today and giving us this information. Our final presentation today will be on the Cancer Control Plan Report. Presenter is Diana Bradshaw, who is Interim Breast and Cervical Cancer Prevention and Control Unit Manager in the Department of Public Health with the Department of Health and Human Services. You'll have to hold it down to talk.
Good afternoon. I'm Dr. Diana Bradshaw. I'm here to talk with you about a brief synopsis of the 211 annual report on the North Carolina Cancer Control Plan. The plan that we have had in effect was started in 2007 and was the plan for 2007 through 2012. We've done really a lot of really good activities with cancer partners toward implementation of the cancer plan. Of course, the overall goal of the cancer plan is to relieve the burden of cancer for North Carolinians. Just as a brief update, we are now evaluating some of the implementation activities that were done, but we do continue to work with the Advisory Committee on Cancer Coordination and Control and those committee members are listed on the back of your handout today. And the advisory committee is a great committee that helps us strengthen our cancer programs as we are looking for grants to help us further relieve the burden and help us with our programs to be done across the state. Some of the issues that have come before the committee in this past 5 years were things like informed decision-making strategies and screening for prostate cancers, development of a continuum for screening, treatment, survivorship, and palliative care, which is, of course, care for a cancer patient across the whole continuum from screening, education through screening, through diagnosis, treatment, and care and end-of-life issues. We are now underway on the new cancer plan, which is the plan for 2012 through 2017. And in this new plan, we will be addressing the top five cancer priorities in North Carolina, which are lung, breast, cervical, prostate, and colorectal. The sixth cancer on the list would be pancreatic cancer, which is almost equal to prostate cancer in the numbers in North Carolina. We appreciate the support we received from the General Assembly, and if there are any questions, I'll be happy to answer them.
Are there any questions from members of the committee for Dr. Bradshaw? Dr. Current?
Are we still giving a substantial grant to Lineberger Cancer Center? It's $50 million. Is that still in the budget?
We'll have to check that out. It's not at the top of our heads right at the moment. We'll get that information for you. Any further questions? Thank you, Dr. Bradshaw, very much for your presentation. Representative Dollar has a question.
I apologize, Mr. Chairman, for not grabbing your arm sooner. Let me just ask a quick question. There was an issue that was brought up by some of the members this past year about men's health and about prostate cancer. And I noticed you had a bullet point item on here. What actions have y'all taken? I remember, I believe there was an item in the budget, actually, that was designed to ask about the department exploring setting up a division of men's health, that sort of thing. But most of the concern, actually, I believe, focused more around prostate cancer. Can you just give us a few minutes about what the department's efforts are in the Division of Public Health on addressing that issue? I mean, obviously, there's been quite a bit of stir around about screening and when there should be screening and not be screening. I know we got the same issue that involves with breast cancer about when to screen, when not to screen.
Well, sometimes it's helpful if you've worked in public health 102 years. So I've been around for some of these issues to be discussed. Yes, we have talked quite a bit in the past year or so about prostate cancer and about screening for prostate cancer. And the issue is not settled even now. CDC still recommends that what we teach to the public is they should have informed decision making. So they need to know about prostate cancer and about what can happen with prostate cancer and about all of the methods that are available to them for treatment. Personally, we advise people as the cancer branch that if you're going to be screened for prostate or any other cancer, you should look at your family history. And if you look at your family history, at whatever age someone in your family was diagnosed with a cancer, then you should begin screening for that cancer 10 years before that age. And so that's the rule of thumb for a family history of cancer of any type.
Let me, Mr. Chairman, I'll try to be quick with this, but just to follow up on something you were saying there. I take it there are times in terms of the North Carolina Cancer Control Plan that our position as a state is we go beyond or have a different
recommendation than the CDC, or do you always try to follow the CDC's recommendation? I mean, I know that most of the recommendations would be fairly similar, but given that in a number of areas there are differences, does the committee that works on these feel free to depart from the CDC when it believes that maybe there's a better approach?
That's one of the important issues about having the Advisory Committee on Cancer Coordination and Control. We will frequently bring issues to the committee, and they will have us put together a position paper, after which time they discuss, the 38 members that are on the committee, discuss the issue, and will frequently make a recommendation or take a stand for the state of North Carolina on what North Carolina believes about that issue. At this point, we have not made any change on prostate cancer beyond informed decision making.
Okay. And just one final thing. I noticed on here that we do have a couple of legislator vacancies right now. Could you remind us, or remind me for my benefit, for this particular committee, what our process is for the appointment of legislators to the committee?
When we have vacancies, we let each of the houses know that there is a vacancy, and also the governor's office when there's a governor appointee. They frequently will ask us to make a recommendation for someone. We have a long list of cancer partners in the state who want to be involved in cancer decision making. And so frequently we will come back with a list of 6 or 10 people that then someone decides who they want on the committee, and they send the names back to us.
Okay. And just one quick follow-up, if you don't mind. I've gone over my time, but the I know that in terms of the Diabetes Advisory Council, we've had a series of meetings that have been called, and then those have been canceled, presumably for budgetary reasons. The Cancer Coordination and Control Committee is a somewhat analogous committee to that. And so my question is have y'all been able to meet, or have there been any issues in terms of getting together quarterly or when this committee meets?
By legislative mandate, we should be meeting quarterly. We only met one time in the past year. We did have some telephone conversations with our leadership in the committee, but because of budgetary conditions, we were only allowed to meet in person one time.
Thank you.
Further questions for Dr. Bradshaw from members of the committee? Seeing no hands raised, thank you very much for your presentation today. Ladies and gentlemen, that brings us to the portion of our agenda now that has to do with committee discussion. Is there any committee discussion for those who are still here? Seeing no hands raised, I declare that this meeting is now adjourned. Thank you very much.